not much there. What we are suggesting, we start Commissioner with... The report we adopted last year, which we all voted on. Maybe you were not here at the time. Maybe you were lead from that. But we noted, as agreed by the committee, what they had said. Not the view of the committee. We said that the majority of the committee, look at 824, feel that National Treasury, for all its challenges, is performing well overall. That was the committee's view as a whole, right? But if you look at 9, that belongs to us, Commissioner. Now, you and the Deputy Minister can say now, did you do what you said you're going to do as a committee, right? Now, let's look. You see, we can open our mouths, as I said yesterday, fold our arms and say, now, Minister, what have you done? As if Parliament doesn't have a role. So we said 3 tasks for ourselves and sub-tasks. On 9-1, we have actually established a very good relationship with the PBO, I must say. It's by leaps and bounds improved since then. No good appropriate research. I've reported to the content advisor, even our staff. We have 10 staff in itself who belongs to another committee, and I think when we come back, that will be finalized. And we are, in fact, working very closely with the Appropriations Committee and, in fact, other relevant committees, as indicated by our work on state-owned companies, on PBP, BEPS, and so on. 9-2, we have, in fact, met all the entities we said we would meet, Minister. All the entities. In fact, as a single entity, I think we didn't meet it. We met everybody. And, in fact, we looked at the annual reports of several of them. This year, we look at the annual reports of others. On a forms and format of parliamentary report, thanks to Bridget's cooperation, that has already begun to happen. We have shorter reports. We focus far more, particularly the last report on the political framework, Bridget, far more on what the committee feels, rather than repeating and regurgitating what's in the report of National Treasury. And we have raised this with the PASDG, but I regret to say not much has happened except a verbal agreement that the report should be shorter. You know, some committees do 50-page reports. And about 45 of them are just a summary of what the executive has said. So, really, Bridget, thanks for your cooperation. Well, I think we have made tremendous progress in that regard. If you look at this very report, it was 11 pages only. And at least 4 of them were what we felt and actually recommended. So I think on most things we've delivered for ourselves, our hardest. Thank you very much. Over then to the issue of looking at the implications of the Kakane report. And so on, the general staff, I think, is that right?
Yeah. Just to clarify on a couple of things. I think the first is that we appreciate the opportunity that the Commission has given us to talk to what is now in the media almost on a daily or weekly basis. The way we're going to approach the issue is that we will give a broad overview of the Kakane report, focusing on its findings and recommendations. We'll then proceed and talk a little bit briefly on the kind of interventions that emanate from that and other discussions that we have been having. I must say up front to you, honorable members, that the Kakane report itself is inconclusive. It is actually work in progress, in the sense that most of what it comes up with it has to be further investigated and elaborated upon. And that explains why we've been very concerned about its wide distribution, because very soon you'll have people writing about people names when there is no conclusive evidence about some of the issues raised. So part of what we'll be explaining is the process beyond that, and it entails a number of areas. The one area is the Judge Brown Board, Advisory Board. The second one is the Reorganization and Performance Enhancement Program that's rising at SARS. And then we'll also talk broadly about some of the human resource interventions, including some of the disciplinary actions and disciplinary processes that we have. The presentation is going to be, I think the Commissioner will run through the presentation and then we can take questions around it. I must say that upfront, honorable members, that because it's almost dealing with a matter that is almost such a decay, there might be questions that we probably might not be able to respond to directly, due to the sensitivity of the nature and the nature of what we're dealing with. Thank you very much. Over to you, Commissioner.
Thank you, DM and members of the committee.
representation will follow a format that we have on the screen. It will cover the five key areas, which is the Skakane board, the synoptic picture about it, the South Advisory Board led by the entire judge of Kruan, and then we'll deal with the reorganization and refocus such processes, and then we'll deal with the human resource component and the process itself. And finally, we'll give a conclusion. We'd like, therefore, to deal with the Skakane report in a synoptic manner. The report is preliminary in nature, and that it seeks to highlight challenges that are in the public domain with respect to the allegations of an existence of a rogue unit amongst others. And we say rogue unit in inverted commas. An MOU between SARS and National Intelligence sought to create a unit with the aim to combat illicit trade and economy. And the unit was to reside within NIA in order to comply with the constitution, the relevant taxation and intelligence legislation. This agreement, the MOU, was never formalized. The existence of the national, the NRG, was then established as a formality and research above. A number of findings prompted the appointment of the Skakane Panel of Investigation as per the SARS Act. This happened in August 2014, before my arrival at SARS. The terms of reference of Skakane report, key amongst, there are so many of them, where we selected the three that are on the screen, an engagement in the corrupt activities, to any possible breach of SARS policies, processes, codes, and good governance. And finally, any act of impropriety in general, or in terms of any law, as well as any allegations that may come to light in the course of the investigation. I think that is very important. Now, the findings of the Skakane report are as follows, in brief. That the establishment, existence, and operations of the National Research Group and or the High-Risk Investigation Unit were unlawful and without the requisite statutory authority. Two, that the unit was operated ostensibly in a covert manner and created a climate of intrigue, fear, subterfuge within SARS. And then it also indicated that there was prima facie evidence that the unit may have abused its powers and resources by engaging in activities that reside in other agencies of government and which it had no lawful authority to form. And the other was that there was prima facie evidence that the unit's activities have included rogue activity, rogue behavior that had had potential to damage the reputation of SARS as an organ of state. Those were the issues that came up as a finding. And then it had recommendations to make. That the commissioner should put in place processes to ensure the following. One, that the unit is disbanded. Let's take a pause on this. When the big article occurred in the 5th of October 2014 and the 12th of October last year, I, as a commissioner, before being privy to this outcome, I had already mentioned in EXCO that the unit should be disbanded forthwith if and when it exists. So when the recommendation came that the unit is disbanded, it was confirming something that I did not know, but confirming exactly that that's what management would like to do. Secondly, that the persons involved in the unit are debriefed, that the persons involved in the unit are protected from intimidation, that the persons involved in the unit be integrated into SARS official and civilian structures. That also formed part of my brief of EXCO membership the 5th and the 12th of October 2014. The report also indicated that it is incumbent upon SARS to put in place a number of processes to investigate first and to reverse incidents of malpractices that emanate from the Skakane report. And we'll deal with the way forward in a synoptic manner. Emanating from the Skakane findings, we as SARS brought in a forensic firm, KPMG, working together with senior counsel to conduct forensic and legal evidence analysis. The KPMG report is expected to be completed by June of this year. Given the nature of the report and other processes that are dependent on the above, we are of the opinion and feeling
that the reason the Chikakane report at this point in time would be prejudicial to the processes that are in place. With that then, to address ourselves to the other key points which in a way are associated with the issue of trying to solve this problem that we have. The Minister in his wisdom and the team established the advisory board headed by a retired judge, F. Gwen, this year. On the 20th of this month, the full complement of the board was appointed and announced to the public and the media. The board comprises of 5 eminent men and women who are external and 2 senior SARS officials who will be sitting in that board. Amongst the duties, or in short, the terms of reference of the Judge Gwen or the advisory board committee, is to advise on the outcomes of the Chikakane report. That's their immediate task. They will also look into the long-term perspective to tax administration within SARS. They will also review the strategic and business plans. They will also review and advise the Minister and the Commission on major operational plans, including modernization and technology systems. That is the operating model. The advisory board will review and advise both the Minister and myself on SARS budget, but also importantly, they will review the governance structure, which is key in any organization. Now, we have also indicated that work at SARS has never come to a grinding halt. Upon my arrival, we came into a conclusion that there is a need to look into the reorganization, refocus, and also do a performance enhancement of SARS operation. May I say, members of the committee, that the current SARS operating model and modernization strategy was introduced in 2007 for a 7-year cycle, ending in 2014. Like any other organization that is in the transformation journey, it takes a point in terms of analyzing and assessing where it has been in the journey that it has taken. For that purpose, the following has happened. In the SARS Annual Report Plan AP for 2013-2014, which I need to refer to members, it indicates that Parliament will review the operating model. This is contained in the annual report that I have here on page 27. But exactly that they're doing is in line with the decision and policies that SARS indicated that it will do. The following independent change agents were commissioned by myself with the support of the Minister and the Ministry. That will bring Bain and Company, Gartner Incorporated, these 2 will deal amongst others. To deal with the broader SARS operating model, analyze dedicated money for the investment made by SARS in the modernization process, that is, looking to return on investment. It will look into the efficacy and efficiency of the systems as well as the ownership of the intellectual property. It will build on internal capability to ensure long-term sustainability of systems and operations in SARS. Most importantly also, deal with broader governance processes within the organization. Having said what I have said, Chairperson and the members of the committee, it is important therefore to reflect on the current situation because we need to deal with the situation as it presents itself. The current situation as far as follows, and I would like to quote the Minister yesterday in the presentation of our strategic plan, when the question was raised about the capability and capacity of SARS to be able to meet its mandate and operate efficiently. I quote, SARS is not about individuals, but it is some total of our magnanimous leadership addressing its core mandate. Unlike a forest which is made of individual trees, because if you cut the trees close quote, then there is no forest. So SARS has men and women who are capable of taking this organization to a higher trajectory. I must say on the 29th of January this year, I convened SARS National Revenue Forum meeting, consisting of all senior managers across the whole country, which was addressed by the Honorable Minister. I must say the establishment of the National Revenue Forum was to address issues associated with the mandate of SARS. And I want to take a pause in this respect as to withdraw attention to this particular important as to the existence of SARS and the mandate thereof, to collect all revenue due, ensure optimal compliance with tax and customs legislation, and provide a customs service that will optimize revenue collection, protect our borders and facilitate trade, close quote. That's what makes substitute what it is. Every other activity is concentrated around this particular mandate. With that in mind, we therefore moved with speed on the 29th of January for the establishment of the SARS Revenue Command Center, which exists across the whole country in the regions. The establishment of this unit was to track and monitor real-time, live, every cent collected that comes into the system. Two, to track and monitor all committed revenue initiatives across the country. What it sought to seek, therefore, to do what is effectively and efficiently revenue collection, which is our mandate. This would like to confirm in this meeting that we'll be able to demonstrate amicably and openly that we shall live by the ethos of what we are supposed to be doing when the revenue period comes to end at the end of this month. But it is important also to deal with HR interventions. With respect to the turnover of people that might have left the organization, to suffice that the departure of some of the people has not created any whatsoever inability of staff to perform efficiently and to do what is expected from the mandate that it has. Some of the key HR interventions are managing, as it is expected in an organization, the disciplinary processes across the organization equitably without fear or favor. Strengthening HR governance processes and deal with broader succession planning and the sustainability of SARS. That is our intervention, members of the committee and the chair. Thank you very much.
Do you want to add anything, Jim?
In conclusion, this is very key. SARS, I believe, as the helm of the organization as accounting officer, is made of highly passionate men and women, committed and dedicated and driven by high purpose. 14,000 plus who strive to make the country and the economy big by collecting all forms of revenue due. And we can say here without any contradiction that we are confident that we are going to reach our revenue target. Thank you very much.
In summary, I think the essence of what you're trying to say is that the Sekhukhune report is one step in the process. Following that, obviously, there is the current KPMG report investigation. There are other Bain interventions, a whole range of interventions. All of those will feed into the Crown advisory report so that it processes and finally integrates and produces a comprehensive report and a set of advice and recommendations to the ministry about what needs to happen moving forward. I must emphasize, though, that there's a lot of work around reorganization and enhancement of performance, etc., so that all of these processes don't impact on negatively on the capacity of us as a key institution in this country. Thank you.
The minister explained that he would have wanted to be here, but he couldn't, so he did apologize. Over to members, there's Piers, David, and Jean. Of course, he... Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. I think I should start by maybe commending the minister for taking the bold step of... or maybe even combined to our request of taking us through what is happening in SARS. I think this exercise is in order and it must be commended. And I fully concur that in the light of the severity of the magnitude of the matters that are being dealt with, I fully concur that it's crucial that this report should not be released in full, so as we give the due processes opportunity to take their course. And Chair, I do have some few things that I wanted to raise about what has been said. If you look at the recommendations, I mean, there are few recommendations that come before the main one that is giving the institutional authority to appoint the advisory board, but also establish, appoint the KPMG. What I want to take, there are other recommendations before that. How far is the institution in terms of implementing those, because those I think are immediate recommendations that the institutions, the Kakani report is like recommended to the institution. How far is the institution with implementing those recommendations? And secondly, Chair, the minister, the DM said in closing that the advisory board will then process whatever that will be made from the DASH as well as from the KPMG process. Now, you look at the composition of the board. There are two SARS or senior SARS officials who are meant to be part of the board. I don't know what are the checks and balances in place to make sure that these two officials, because remember we are subjecting SARS to an investigative process and no one is immune. So if you bring these two officials, I mean, to what extent are we going to process going to make sure that they don't end up having undue influence in this process? I'm a bit concerned. Maybe you can clarify. Chair, as much as I agree that the report should not be released in full, and I think the reasons related to that. I just want to cite my wish. My wish is on issues that I think should come out at the end of this process, you know. My first wish is to get exactly who authorized the establishment of this unit. And my second wish is to establish, if this process can establish the funding model that was obviously employed, to fund this, the activities of this institution. My first wish is to get more clarity, because if it's a unit, obviously there were others attached to the unit, so it simply says this unit was not just operating from nowhere. It was operating with resources. So let's get to know of these resources, but also the liabilities. Is there any liability that has been incurred by this unit? Because going forward from an oversight perspective, we have to obviously entertain those things. But also, Chair, I will highly appreciate if the unit is really it happened that, because I remember in one of our oversight exercises before your appointment, Commissioner, the DM, we were very worried about the turnover in SARS. The rate of turnover, cases that are going through, that are being litigated in SARS. I will be very much excited if we get information as to the relationship of this rate of turnover with the cited unit. That's my wish list. And as to whether these wishes will be covered in the final report, I mean something else. But our last thing, I'll be very much excited if some of these wishes are ultimately entertained in the final report. Thank you very much, sir.
I don't know why there are wishes. I mean, there are perfectly fit and legitimate demands, requests. Parliament has the right to raise those issues. That's our job. So I agree with what Comrade did saying, but I think it's not a wish list. It's actually presumably a set of requests. It's perfectly legitimate for a member of parliament to raise that. Over to you, David.
Thank you, Chair. Just by starting to say that we always had the impression, and this was advocated from all platforms in South Africa, that SARS is a world-class organization. It always has been. We've achieved fantastic results. It was one of the pillars of strength in terms of our constitution, the mandate that it had, the revenue collection, and it formed the pillar as to our fiscal framework. And I get the impression, and it's unfortunate, Commissioner, that I must disagree with you with regards to the importance of individuals, that many individuals were first, that had a lot of competency. If I can take an example, I've always referred my queries in terms of tax queries. The morning, by the afternoon, it was settled, done and dusted. At this point in time, I find it difficult to locate the correct persons, but we'll speak about that administrative incompetencies perhaps in person, and I'm sure that's something we can address. Commissioner, I find it a pity that I don't have the presentation that you did today, that I can find a correct connect between the four reports. So we have the Kikani report, the KPMG report, now the Bain is also included, which I think is a step in the right direction, I must say. I think it's a very reputable firm, and in terms of restructuring, they're doing wonderful work. But also with regards to the current advisory report, just to see how those different initiatives are connected. That would have helped if we had a written report. Perhaps if you can just give us in terms of timeline some correct connect. And with regards to the Sinkani report, I must say it's a bit mind-boggling to me, because there was a memo of understanding and that was never implemented. But certainly there was an investigating unit that, as you said, created the climate of fear. It was, the establishment was unlawful and it had to be dismantled, so to speak. I think we need a lot of information with regards to that, actually what happened and what the implications of this is. And hopefully we will get that once that finally the current advisory report has been formalized. With regards to, people, individuals, that is not important, I think. In any business, the individual is very important. And I think those people that we have lost, of course, will leave a huge vacancy in the organization. And you need to close that gap again. Let me just give this. Yes, then I would like your views with regards to these, your view on broader government processes. What exactly does that mean? You had a new mandate in terms of broader government processes that you've mentioned. And what processes do you think is there that we should take note of? And then in the public domain, there's the perception of the inaccountability in terms of tax. Your views on that, I would like. And then also with regards to the political party that imported some T-shirts for the bat issue, and that there's a lot of speculation that some people were purged out of the organization because of non-compliance in those two issues that I've mentioned. Whether that's still on the table, whether SARS is looking at that, we would like some clarity with regards to that. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm not really saying thank you today for the report. I think it's very little and it's very late. I submitted a prior application for the report. It was declined. I appealed and that was also declined. And I think until we see it in the public domain, the narrative will not go away. And that narrative is that SARS is hiding something. And that is not good for the social contract. I would like a response as to why I did not get that application approved. And then the Sikakani report, which we didn't get today, I would like to know whether it spoke about a judicial commission of inquiry. Because a judicial commission of inquiry can do a lot more and will have a far more teeth than an advisory board. My concern is that an advisory board do some work and we won't get to the bottom of this problem. So I think we should rather have a judicial commission of inquiry if we're taking this matter seriously, as we should. My understanding also is that the report talks specifically about Johan van Lochtenberg regarding this unit, not specifically on Jerome Frey, Clifford Collins, Arden Delay, Peter Richner, Barry Hall.
Yes. Let's get some clarity. We've got a lawyer. The reason I say this is, can do help. I know that in the House we have immunity, but in a committee, do we actually have the same immunity that you can say what you like? What I would prefer is that we don't mention individuals, because from what I can gather, am I correct? They are going to court, they are CCMA or Labour Court processes still outstanding. There are other legal issues, and you're right, this is not going to disappear. It's going to persist over time. So I just want some guidance. Can you help here? We can get Advocate Jenkins. I'm not sure. Can we defer discussing individual names at this stage? But we've got up to 1 o'clock, and we'll get some. Can you get Advocate Jenkins from here? Is he here? Okay, she's calling. So we get some advice on that matter. Okay.
Can I carry on with my question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Just for record, we know that Van Lochtenberg has resigned, he's left SARS, there's no connection, there's no anything pending, so I have no idea. But anyway, I will move on to the next one.
I'm not really loud, I'm just saying let it legal advice.
Yes. Okay, let's do that. Then,
presumably this has been recorded, right? So, I don't know whether it costs us on TV and parliamentary channels, so presumably the individuals or the recipients will also either listen into or watch, or they might have people representing them here. So for all those reasons, we're not precluding people. This is not, it's an open committee. People have a right to speak, but there are rules which apply to everybody.
if I can put the question, the question was on what basis were they suspended? And then specifically why I asked that question is about capacity at SARS. Now, we did speak yesterday about strategic plan for SARS. Now, it says specifically one of the risks was continuity, obviously, of leadership. It is obvious that if you take out a group of executives at the same time, it does impact an organization. No matter what we think it might not do, it does do that. Also, specifically on IT, the information technology platform is a very important one. We know that e-filing has worked very well, etc. The capacity in IT resignation and resignations in IT is very troubling because that platform is important. So I'd like some commentary on specifically on resignations in IT. Then also, the Commissioner did mention the capacity of SARS and that this will not impact on the ability of SARS to collect its revenue. Obviously, that remains to be seen. I have my concerns specifically regarding the social contract, as I mentioned yesterday. Reputation matters in these situations, and there is no doubt that the reputation of SARS has been sullied by this situation. I would like to know what is going to be done by SARS to work towards rectify that, maybe improving the social contract in the public eye so that we don't have any revenue problems going forward. I also understand that the Commission requested a new official car and that that had caused some consternation within SARS. So I'd like some commentary on that, please. Then I would like to talk about the who paid for this unit. Now, what surprises me is that this unit is a big surprise to everybody because we already knew in 2009, I knew there was a unit operating at SARS. It was raised then, and I was told that every tax authority had an investigative unit. So there was no problem, apparently, at that time, and then suddenly it became one. When the narrative on this rogue unit, so there was a unit, the question is whether they were legitimate or not, I would expect, so apparently they were investigating various syndicates, etc., as far as I understand. I did ask the Auditor General as to how was this unit being funded, because it wasn't shown up anywhere in the financial of SARS. The Auditor General told me that they didn't find anything irregular, and as you can read all the financial reports, there wasn't any. Now, I guess it's that the Auditor General does a sampling situation, so maybe you would have found anything. But apparently lots of money was spent on this unit. And if so, well, then where did the money come from? And how did it get in then that the Auditor General didn't even see the flow of money running through the veins of this unit? That is quite interesting, and I will ask some more questions on that as well of the Auditor General. Then, apparently, the unit was investigating politicians, including our president and associates of the president. And that, apparently, is why this unit suddenly became such a big problem, where everybody knew this was there before. I'd like some commentary on that. And then, finally, on KPMG, the forensic investigation and looking at the legal evidence, etc., what are they going to do differently to the Auditor General? Because has anybody spoken to the Auditor General about this income stream then that seems to be quite irregular? And what's absolutely astounding to me, and as my colleague David Ross said earlier, is that SARS has always been one of the jewels in the crown of the public service. To see a stream of money running through it somewhere that nobody knows about and it's not accounted for is extremely troubling to the taxpayers, and everybody in South Africa who buys anything is a taxpayer because of that. So that is a big thing, and we must get to the bottom of that. And I don't think we've got any closer to anywhere today, frankly. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, Chair, I think it's important for us to remember that this is a standing committee on finance, and the advisors, given the appetite on the matter, they are welcome as well, because we are very open people. Notwithstanding that, Chairperson, I think, you know, Chair, there is something that has to be said. SARS remains a world-class organization. Being world class does not mean that you are not going to be facing challenges on the way. It does not denote a state of perfection, because we are all in pursuit of that perfection. And what is important is that when you actually pick up the problem, you've got to be able to deal with it. And that's what we are trying to do here. And the part of the reason why the way we are going to be exercising our system of the oversight prudently is to ensure that all these issues that are being brought up are dealt with in order to maintain the world class status of SARS. And that is the motive, and that is the perspective from which I'm coming from. Other people might be coming from other perspectives. And there is also something that has to be said, especially because there is something that we are not confronting in this country. You know, and I'm going to be saying this because we seem to run away from this thing. You know, in South Africa, you might actually find people coming up with very genuine, legitimate concerns. But you lose it when you can sense that it's punctuated by covert racism, deeply ingrained, that will synonymize a black person with incompetence. And that is something that we also have to deal with. Because I speak here, I do not represent incompetence. And I am not a synonym of incompetence. And I know a lot of black men and women who are not a synonym of incompetence. And I think we have to isolate these issues. And when we are dealing with the scene, let's not try and directly bring some connotations that are going to actually confuse us in the process, and we end up not really tackling the issue that we are supposed to be confronting here. So having said that, the reality of the situation is that now that we know that there has been this so-called rogue unit, we obviously, and I'm going to align myself with Comrade Death, that we need to know who authorized the establishment of this rogue unit and why were the procedures not followed. Because these are the things that you have to do when you're performing objective oversight. And because the reality of the situation is that we also are aware that there were things that were positive, that were performed by this unit. But we are a government, and we have processes and procedures that have to be followed. And obviously, when this establishment was done, there ought to have been processes and procedures and adherence to the law. We cannot be seen here to be tolerating unprocedural things, illegal establishment of things where the law is conveniently applied and in other instances is not applied. I think that's going to be important for us to do that. The other thing that I also need to check from you, Commissioner, is that we are saying there is a parallel process. First of all, we are saying that this report is preliminary and is not yet complete. But at the same time, we are saying we have appointed the KPMG to conduct a forensic. One suspects one might assume that it may be a prima facie evidence of some wrongdoing in the process. Is that the case? Or you are doing that as part of the process of getting into the details of the matter?
Advocate Jenkins has asked for empowered.
Oh, we are empowered. Thank you, Sandy.
I'm communist here, but everybody else who doesn't belong to the party wants to operate as cooperative. I apologize on behalf of Auntie Tandy.
Okay, no problem. I'm used to her.
I want to thank her very much for not heckling me. Very early in the day.
Okay, I wanted to find out around the appointment of KPMG and the fact that they are going to be conducting a forensic audit, and one wants to establish you know, the factors or what prompts that? Is there any prima facie evidence or something like that that is leading us to that? And secondly, I also wanted to know, in fact, I wanted to stress what I had said even yesterday on the issues of HR. You see, SARS has been around for a long time, and obviously you will have people that lead the organization for one reason or the other, but obviously it becomes a concern when you have a lot of people leading at the same time who have critical skills that are necessary for the organization. Now, I think it's going to be absolutely important that we get that comprehensive HR report that is going to give us the essence of the age profile, a very detailed report as the committee, so that we can be clear that we are not losing critical skills, because SARS is the only place that can really attract your tech experts. If we lose those people, then even our test becomes weakened, and that's very important for us to look very closely to scrutinize the HR component of it. The other question that I also wanted to know, Commissioner and your Deputy Minister, is that probably this is prompted by my own experience when I was the chair of the Ministerial Advisory Committee on Social Grants. You know, this thing of appointing, we appointed Bain and Gunn. And my understanding, and please do correct me if I am wrong, you are saying part of their role, your mandate that they've been given is to also assist you with the operating model. And obviously that is also going to require the IT, it goes hand in hand with the IT platform. And I wanted to know whether were there no South African companies that are as competent to perform that task than these two, and also, I also want to know what is the cost involved. I want to tell you something that happened in another place where I was. We purchased this shopping at some point, this apartment, purchased it, they paid over 2 billion, and nobody's using it. And that's something that is going to be important for us to establish whether it is compatible, the compatibility, whether this and also the cost involved. We also need to establish the cost involved. And Chair, finally, I wanted to say, I want us to remember that the underlying ethos of SARS are such that we cannot afford to have SARS being questioned. I'm not talking in the sense of actually getting the responses that we want to get, but I'm talking about the integrity of SARS. So I wanted to understand what is being done to ensure that we actually protect the integrity of SARS. And we make sure that, you know, the taxpayers out there feel and can have something tangible. Maybe Minister, the Business Minister, you might tell us about what is something that is tangible that we can probably share with the South Africans in terms of, you know, convincing South Africans that SARS is still the well-oiled machine that we know it to be. It's still the world-class organization that we know it to be. Thank you.
That is a bit difficult to throw you into the deep end, as it were, right? But you're familiar with at least some level of the issues in SARS, right? Around this unit that was established, this questionable sort of legality. But also, even the peasants in Mongolia know about the story. It's been in the paper for 9 months, right? So you know that there are people who have been dismissed or suspended or whatever status they have. Some of them, it seems, are going to court. Now, a member on this committee, firstly, can I ask you a question? I don't understand that the immunity we have in the House is not replicated in the committee meetings. That's what, so what we say is that we can be held to account for in a way we can't if we say the same thing in the House. Is that correct? Well, does the committee have the same immunity?
We have the same immunity, Chair.
Oh, we do.
All members.
Okay. In a committee meeting?
Yes,
okay, that's clarified. Having said that, the second thing is that what do you suggest? A member is raising questions about individuals, and I think, am I right? He's actually asking, why was so-and-so suspended? What are the grounds on which so-and-so is suspended? Now, if these people are so challenging or are likely to challenge in a labor court or the CCMA process or some other court process, or they're involved in some sense of negotiations with the Treasury management, would it be okay to ask the question? And then the next question is the Treasury obliged to answer? I don't know what other question is going to raise about the legality of that. Anybody wants to add to that? Nope. Okay, can you answer that, please?
Chairperson, first of all, I want to start at the back end. The strange thing in the Constitution that certain officials that give evidence to the NGOP and its committees will enjoy privilege or the protection of parliamentary privilege, but the same is not said in the part that relates to the National Assembly. So it's an issue for officials. For me, the question, I would defend an official that they also enjoy that immunity. But for them to for sure enjoy it in terms of the Powers and Privileges Act, they need to be sworn in to be giving testimony, and then whatever they say cannot be held against them. Chairman, person, the issue of the sub judice, if I may use that word, it's one must distinguish the sub judice application in Parliament to what the courts consider sub judice. The courts are basically saying their judgments, we are not as sensitive as you think we are. It must really be a substantial impact on the administration of justice. And a real likelihood, please don't quote me, there's a case, the Meadey case that deals with that. But that's not at all the test that Parliament applies. We apply a sub judice test as a self-imposed rule, notwithstanding the privilege, out of respect for the judiciary and respect for judicial processes. I must add a last one because certain HR issues are administrative processes, it's not really judicial processes. But Parliament applies this to protect those processes for them to run forth. And the question that you referred to, and that's where you started, there's always a likelihood that a question like that could go into an area where, because it's publicized afterwards in the media, it might or might not jeopardize the negotiations around a certain issue, certain cause of action. And that's a big challenge for Parliament to deal with that. So what usually happens is the chairperson will warn a member to say, look, we cannot go into an area where there's a likelihood that the process will be jeopardized. I mean, Parliament cannot be seen to impact negatively on other arms of government or administrative processes. The person who's been asked the question, chairperson, if they are sworn in, they must answer the question, unless there's a legal reason why they can't, if there's a lawful reason. Otherwise, they must answer the question. If they're not sworn in, of course, it's a matter of choice, but Parliament being what it is, we can always summon someone and compel them in terms of our constitutional power and the powers in the Powers and Privileges Act of Parliament to force the answer out of them. Not in the same way that the CIA would do it, but by holding them in terms of Parliament. Thanks, Chair.
Now, firstly, John, don't you think the series of questions you've asked covers you in a way? Do you really want to focus on individuals? I'm asking the question. Secondly, can I finish? This is a committee. It's an oversight committee. It's not a CCMA process. It's not a labor court process. It's not a commission of inquiry. It's not a tribunal. We have very good legislation that deals with all of those things. And from what I can observe, often the people who go to these courts win their cases. So, you know, I think you have set out a very clear set of issues that are preoccupying you and presumably your party. Does it matter each individual case that you want to raise? Or can we strike some agreement? I don't know, I'm asking questions as a way out. I don't know. I mean, I haven't been in this situation before. Neither Alan, unless Alan and Esther can help us, you know, we could actually maybe ask you to deal with this matter informally outside this meeting. I don't know if that's a possibility. But what I'm saying in short is that does the matter to the issues you've raised to focus on specific individuals?
Thank you, Jason. No, we do not have to go into the specific individuals. The reason why I mentioned them, because it is And this is not secret, this is in the public domain. Jerome Fraser, head of modernization and strategy. Clifford Collins, the anti-corruption head. Arne Pillay, the deputy commissioner. Peter Richter, strategy planning. And Barry Hall, the COO. These are all very senior people who are not there anymore. So, my question is this, and that's why I wanted the Kakani report, because the report apparently talks about this irregular unit, the rogue unit and these rogues, and therefore there was action taken, apparently on that basis. But we've never seen that, so we do not know if that's so. My question is, the people that I've mentioned, having occupied these senior positions, are not there anymore. My concern is the ability of staff to then do the job it's supposed to do, given the economy the way that it is. So I ask the question is, on what basis were they suspended? Because if the report, which we haven't seen, says these people all did terrible things and this is why they got suspended, whatever, then it would be clear. But it isn't clear. And my feeling on this matter is that that is in this report. There is no damning evidence here that is going to be leading to dismissal and suspension, and that perhaps there's something else that led to it. That's the point that I'm making. So if it is this something else, if all of the executives are gone, why? While he was doing the job, they're chasing after a particular individual, I don't know. That's why I ask the question. So in the absence of that, I don't know. But certainly what we must do in this committee, and we've been lecture on it a long time, is we must do our job. And our job is to make sure that we have oversight over SARS effectively. Because if SARS falls over and we don't collect the revenue like we should, our deficit of 162 billion rand is going to get bigger, and our economy is going to wobble even more than it is now. So I am very worried about it, and so is anybody else out there. So I speak on behalf of people out there who pay their tax every single day, every month or whatever, and they're wondering now, what's going on with this unit? Because it is good. So in the absence of proper information and evidence, what are you supposed to do? You can't speculate, because that's not helpful either. But what we'll do is get to the bottom of it. So that is why I raise it. Thank you, Chair.
You are, in effect, asking, in each individual case, why the person was suspended.
You don't need to go into that, I believe.
Okay, of course.
I wanted you to assist. I thought that probably what would be sufficient is for the commissioner and the deputy minister to come out clean. Are there any individuals that are being purged? Thank you.
Is anybody else want to answer? Yes.
Oh, no. Just on a lighter note, Chair. When Honorable George was referring to people being worried outside there. The outside there was directly pointing at the new participant in our committee, Honorable President Bach. So now I'm not sure. I'm not sure if Honorable President Bach has been brought in and then to observe or to. Or maybe the vote of no confidence on the two competent PA members that are in our committee.
Basically, the rules obviously allow any member, as I understand it, to participate in any committee. So I think, Mr. President Bach, you are welcome to be here. I also think that while there is this banter, we are not detracting from the seriousness of the issues. But things in general, if you like, which your party we come from, are pretty grim, you know, in the economy globally, let alone South Africa. And we can't all be tearful all the time. So a bit of banter is human. But we also not detecting from the seriousness of the issues. I see Pinky Hannah.
Thank you, Chair. Just one or two things. I think the impression that we want the minister and the commissioner to get, and that's something that we'll want them to, the assurance that we'll want them to give to us as a committee. Chair, we have a responsibility to play oversight over SARS and all other institutions that relate to us. And I don't think as a committee we will allow anything to go under the carpet. That is not what we'll stand for. We also represent a constituency, and we want to say to the deputy minister and the commissioner that at some point we will want to also go through those reports, the Kakani, the PwC, and all those KPMG and all other activities that are taking place. Let's give them time, let them deal with that, but at some point we'll also have an opportunity formally as a committee to go through all this. So there shouldn't be any impression that is being created that as a committee we don't want to. And I think that's the assurance that we in fact we don't need their assurance, because they are required to make sure that as a committee we are given all these things. That's the first thing. I was also listening to Honorable George, and I don't want to be tempted to go into what Honorable Magosi was saying about the names he was reading out of people who have been who are going through DC and other things. I'm not sure whether it's intentionally or not, but amongst other people who are very senior in SARS, some of them, three or so, have been expelled. Why is it not in his interest to also include those in the names of the people who are part of the so-called paging, if that is the case? So I don't want to start to go back to what Honorable Magosi was saying, that why is there some level of racial issues around those kind of things. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to... Chair, I tend to be a little bit serious today when we discuss SARS, and I'll reserve my usual excitement for subtle matters that doesn't impact on the country. Specifically because when we discuss matters of this nature, playing to the gallery does not help. One thing that I've learned, and I'm still learning, is that a committee of finance, not any other committee, it's a committee that is linked to the markets. It's a committee that is linked to continuous assessment by rating agencies and so on. So when we deal with matters of this nature, we need to be careful at how we deal with things in the interest of the country. So that's why I reserved my normal jargon, trying to bring lighter issues in the committee. Therefore, I will suggest that when we engage in these matters, we exercise some form of patience, because we'll have ample time to engage into the contents of all the reports, not only the Sikakani report, but all other reports, including the KPMG report and many other reports that relate to this, so that our oversight intervention is not seen as a political posturing, but an effective oversight over government. Because it's in the interest of all of us, as parties and representatives of the public, to continuously do effective oversight and not be selective as to at what juncture and at will be effective and who we tend to represent. Because as we are here, we do not represent individuals affected by any decision taken by the state, but we represent the taxpayers. So I call for all of us, when we engage in this report, first to take this as a preliminary report that will actually translate into a later discussion. And I assume the reason why you have put the report on the agenda, it was because of the pleas of getting some information, hence you scheduled it to happen in first quarter.
So I want to beg for the indulgence of the members to accept the first preliminary report and give ourselves an opportunity on our own at a later stage to engage, so that when we are given the final report, we'll have applied our minds. So that, and I hope, because, you know, our friends, the media, will not be there, will be a little bit more sober when we do it, because there will not be photos, nice photos for newspapers, and then were created to be seen to have done work. The actual work will continue as usual, where there is no a lot of attention that we will get to that. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just wanted to comment very briefly about the quite frankly weird and bizarre racial commentary that I've had to be subjected to today. It's quite unfortunate. But I just want to say that I don't know what the race of the people are on this list. I have no idea what their race is. What I do know is what job they do at or did at SARS. That's what I know. And that's why they're on my list. Maybe there's a lot more. And if I have a lot more names, I'll read them out too. But that's the whole point. So I really think it's very unfortunate that we have to go into that weird space, because it's totally irrelevant. Totally irrelevant. Thank you.
I've been stealing the meeting. I think it's, I would have a right to speak. Though as a chair, I have to be a bit more subdued than I otherwise would be, so I'm feeling restrained. But let me just say firstly that I think it is sad and unfortunate what has happened. I don't think anybody in their right mind would be happy about the events of the last 9 months or so. The commissioner also came in at a time where this exploded. I was drawing my attention yesterday that actually the issue first blew up in the media shortly before he was appointed. Is that correct? So I think one should also be empathetic, if you like, if not empathetic, that anybody, any one of us, if we were to be commissioner at that time, newly appointed, effectively we are thrown in at the deep end. I also would like to suggest that whatever party political differences we have, there are some things that are in the national interest, if you like. And it doesn't serve anybody's interest, whichever party they are, however opposed that to the government, to undermine certain institutions. It actually erodes the fabric of the entire society. I don't think anybody wants to see SARS completely sort of, you know, reduced in its capacity to function, its credibility, and so on. Right? And I don't think our differences are as great as is being made out here. I also think what we should be clear about is what I think one of the members said, that Ulster doesn't involve just this one city. We have, as you know, in this 5-year term, introduced quarterly reports presented to this committee. And were it not for the way the thanks bill panned out, we would have had a sitting out in this week with SARS and NTMI, correct, with a quarterly report. So we'll be doing, if all goes well, 4 quarterly reports. We'll be monitoring them. Now, I think that, you know, it's not just the taxpayers out there that are prejudiced. It's the average citizen, even if he or she doesn't pay taxes. Because the revenue that he's raised primarily serves the poor and the disadvantaged. So, you know, I think it's all citizens whom we represent in our different ways and in different proportions who are affected by what's going on. I think it's correct what one member said, or more than one member, that actually this must be understood as an initial foray into the subject. We could not have a meeting before today. Earliest been last week. We understood this thing blew up in the press. When the minister and commissioner came here in November last year with the annual report, said we would by the end, by the first quarter, we came in here having to process the auditing bill quickly. Then there was the budget and the 60-day cycle of the money bill act. So we had no choice. In fact, we said the first week after we finish the fiscal framework, we'll have the minister. But then we had to take the step. And so we met as early as possible in the circumstances. Now, I have been in constant touch with the chair of the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence
In fact, I spoke with her as recently as last night. Now, we have evolved, if you like, a complementary division of labor in who does what. Now, the Joint Standing Committee of Intelligence has had an initial discussion about how to manage this crisis. They were going to meet last week Tuesday, but because of the appointment of the Inspector General, they postponed their meeting. I spoke to Connie September yesterday to the first week or second week of the next quarter. So they are looking, because most of the issues, after consultation with the appropriate structures, the decision is that they would look, because it falls under the intelligence issues. They also have, if I am correct, they have an Inspector General's report on this matter, which report cannot be given to us. So they are looking at the issue of the formation of this unit, to what extent it is legal or not, and those sort of issues. To what extent, even if it's outside the law, presumably, what it did may have been understandable in the context of cooperation with other state security agencies and so on. Those are not issues that fall within our portfolio. They are dealing with that. Mm-hmm. I am not sure, DM, whether you can answer this question, whether they will be given the Sakai report, right? I don't know. But so the first thing to understand is there's a division of labor between the Joint Standing Committee of Intelligence and this committee. What we are seeking to do is to look at the implications of the Sikakane report on the performance and functioning of SARS. And I think a week from now or so, as is the norm, the minister announces together with the commissioner the results for the last financial year. Whether SARS has achieved its goal or exceeded it or fallen below it. Am I right? That will be done by the 1st of April or so? Right. So that will be done there, and that will be at least one important measure of how what has happened over the last 9 months has impacted on SARS. So if members are wanting to be skeptical, and so they should be, you can't be a parliament just unconditionally accepting what the executive does, which is not to say that the members of the executive or the commission are deliberately misleading us. They are presenting the facts as they know them, presumably, and looking from the perspective of the executive. Parliament has to be questioning and critical, whichever party members may come from. So let's see what the results are. According to the minister, he said he just said it, and I thought he also said it earlier in some media forum. He says that they're on course. And he hinted that there might be some surprises to observe when he announces, together with the commissioner, the results. So I don't know, DM Commissioner, whether you can say anything that won't undermine your processes. Or anything, you might want to comment on that. Because that is one important indication of how this has impacted the SARS, which is not to say that you only look at the results to determine the consequences of the loss of senior personnel from SARS in the last month. So the second area I'd like to emphasize, and I think it's been covered by other members, is that this report is at this stage not available. We've also asked, by the way, John, only yesterday I asked for the report, right? And I was given the answer the DM gave now. Now, I'm not sure whether the thing would hold later down the road. So, DM, if it is possible for us to have the report at an appropriate stage, I think that's what should be made available to the committee's concerned, right? Now, what we're also asking for, bearing in mind that we looked this up, Advocate Jenkins, if I recall, at some stage, Srini Jhawala, the speaker there, requested some legal opinion on whether Parliament, the older journalists, you might remember the story, whether Parliament can have any and every report that the executive prepares. And I remember attending a committee of chairpersons where we were told, I was a bit surprised about that actually, said no. The executive, in the most open of democracies, they have certain reports, not like Advocate Jenkins, that they are entitled to keep. What criteria is used about that, I'm not sure. But maybe you can guide us on that, you know, if you want to say something towards this meeting, fine. But we would like, at some stage, for the Sikakane report to be released. We're also saying that, if possible, now I don't know the internal report, we would also like other related reports, the KPMG report, if somebody says, there's a Bain report, I only hear about for the first time today, even if there's a reservation about it, but I'm not, sorry?
What is that? Company that has been appointed.
What are they going to be doing? They're doing a report.
They're doing
yeah, they're doing a report, yeah. That's the Bain report in the sense the company is doing the report. maybe that can be made available to us. Right? What we are saying is, let's look at the rules of parliament. What is appropriate to us? It's nothing to do with the DA alone. All of us, other members of the ANC and Senate, would like the report that's appropriate at an appropriate stage. So what I'm saying is that we must see this as Tambi says, an initial foray into the area. It's complementary to what the JSC is doing. There are other reports at work in progress, and we will come back to this issue. We won't actually end this matter here. But I will engage more with Connie, and we will engage with the Speaker's office as appropriate and necessary to check where the boundaries, what we do and what they do, because they function in a different way. So, I do think, as I say, that if there was some way in those who have exited or been after exit or whatever form, and those who are currently the management strike, some sort of reconciliation. It's accepted that people have gone, but I think people are concerned about their legacies and the way they're seen in the public domain. If some such thing could be done, I think this committee will be pleased, because we don't want this thing to fester, not with, you know, an institution as important as yours and the country's commissioner. Yeah. So if there are some ways that you can negotiate and settle these outstanding matters in an amicable way, it's something that I think most of us in the committee will welcome. Having said that, I want to stress to the committee, we'll come back to this issue. Sorry? Yeah, you can say whatever you want. I mean, you know, provided there's immunity. I just come down this full immunity. Right. And I also want to say something else. Yes, I think maybe, you see, on the one hand, I want to suggest, right, I would prefer people not to have an endless exchange with me on this matter. So let me choose my words carefully now. And I'll be very measured. You see, on one hand, it is interesting, for me at least, that there is a racialized subtext to this, that the people who occupy these positions, for historical and other reasons, come from certain communities. Some of them are deeply entrenched in the movement that brought liberation primarily. So, if you look at them, it'd be wrong to look at their face without looking at who they are. Then you're going to talk about, I'm not thinking of saying this, we're really careful of you saying, Joe Slobo and Jeremy Cronin and all of that, right? So, I think that's it. But it does show that 21 years down the road, and this committee, Dez has been raising this thing since, people might recall, in the first sitting we had here, Dez raised this thing, because he said, look, he's not happy with House's demographic representability, right? In this very report that's here that we went through, it says here under 821, I think it's Dez's point. He raised this with you in July last year. He raised, you not here, then Mr. Pillay, Commissioner Pillay, raised it with you presumably in, no, this is July's report. Then I think you and us raised about demographic representativity, not only in the context of the national question, but the gender question. So this is an issue that preoccupies this committee, right? It's not related to this issue. And on the other hand, I'm saying that we shouldn't over-racialize it, because we're wrong to look at people's race alone, as we all know, without looking at what contribution they've made. And I don't think we should do it, but people are right to draw attention to it. It's very interesting. 21 years down the road, this is not. We raised with you, dear, only a month ago, with the auditing bill, 21 years down the road, that 6% of the auditors are African and only 23% women. This entire committee, not least the DA, supported that. It's wrong. In fact, I think Dave, you raised it in the House. So, in other words, let's not over-racialize it, but let's not run away from the fact that we, to our peril, actually fail to de-racialize this country in important institutions, right? We raise questions about gender representativity in the judiciary, about SARS being not demographically representative. We've asked about the auditing profession. So I don't think people are wrong to rate it, but it should not become the focus of the issue. I don't think people intended that. So can we move on from the race issue and we'll deal with them as when we have to, of course, you can speak. Sorry? Sorry? Are they going to hug? I love to see Dion hug. Of course, you can imagine. Okay, so let's not have an endless discussion. Okay.
Okay. I don't want this committee to have the impression that we are over-racializing issues. However, what we are saying is that there is a serious threat in South Africa of covert racism. That is a threat. We cannot run away from it. And it's important that it should be noted. Let's not water it down. I say the matters have been over-racialized. We've gotten into the substance of the issues. We've looked at all the substantive issues over and above. The racial issues were just a byway effect, but they remain important because we want it to be judged by the content of our character.
Argument to both sides. Yeah. Or both sides. Let's move on and deal with the issues now. Ian, you want to say something?
Look, after a summary, probably would say a few things in response. I would look at the concerns raised by Dion and David, I think, and everybody in the house around sustaining the performance of SARS and maintaining SARS' image as a world-class organization is probably at the core of what we're doing. So it's not, I mean, most of the work that we're doing, if you really pause and look at it, it's attempting to accept and strengthen that image. And if we have time, we could actually give details in terms of some of the issues. That is why we have avoided an approach that was piecemeal to the problem, a short term. We have adopted an approach that is comprehensive. Our response is comprehensive. If you look at the elements of our response, we were saying that the Sikakane report lifts up a number of issues that need to be pursued further. In order to pursue them, we actually needed to drill down into the issues as they raised. That is why we had the KPMG process. But equally, we also realized that we need to strengthen and sustain performance and ensure that the structure of SARS, its operations, its processes remain world class. That is why we then said we need Bain and Gartner to come in so that they look at the system, they look at the structure, they look at all these things before. Now, so that we can sustain that image and continue to strengthen tax administration in the country. In addition to that, we said that we would not want to conduct an investigation in the media, basically. What we then said was that it's crucial that we have another intervention which looks at broader tax administration issues, governance issues, tax governance issues in relation to SARS. That's why we then said we needed to appoint a credible committee or board that almost like receives all these reports, takes all these recommendations, integrates it into an immediate, medium-term, and long-term program for strengthening tax administration in the country. Our approach is much short-term. We are not responding to this only to kind of deal with these issues and for tomorrow. We're actually looking at it long-term so that we don't have a repeat of some of these things in the future. That's essentially our approach. So I would want to emphasize that. I must also emphasize, because I think there's been an insinuation that things that are hidden around, put around the carpet or something like that. I must stress this thing that we've deliberately avoided personalizing these issues for a number of reasons, because you get distracted because you are busy following individuals. That's why we actually draw our attention to the core issues. There are processes to deal with some of the personal issues that arise out of this. But finally, I think more important, and which I think is very important, when you ask us about matters, tax matters relating to individuals, the law is very clear. We cannot publicly be discussing tax matters relating to individuals. It's just against the law. So it has to maintain that standard of ensuring that if you are saying there's a particular matter relating to that individual, unless the particular individual goes to SARS and raises the issue, and SARS will deal with it. And so there are explanations about some of the things that you're talking about which have no base effectively. If you ultimately we will give the report, and now we're saying that it is a process matter. Where we are at the moment, we have the Kakana report that has taken us up to a particular point, lifts and a couple of issues, raised a number of concerns, made a number of recommendations. Beyond that point, we're dealing into these issues. Once we think we have a comprehensive picture, we will actually hand over the report to the committee. And that's part of the process. The danger of giving the Kakana report now, you would have a process of public persecution of individuals, and the process will be derailed, actually, if we do it in the process, in the middle of a process that we think is quite constructive in dealing with this. So I thought it's important that you say that. My last point, Chair, around performance, I think as Treasury, we are more concerned on performance. And it, obviously, we have. I mean, we have to protect the levels of revenue collection in the country. We have to improve our tax administration. So we'll be the last to actually temper with that in any negative way. So part of what we've been doing and emphasizing from the beginning, when the commissioner came in, we said to the commissioner, your priority is going to be ensuring that the performance of us is maintained, that we maintain the levels and even improve the levels of revenue collection in the country. And that's why the reorganization process and refocusing process has been very important for us, because actually we tried to achieve that, as it were. And I must say that it has achieved some results. There is momentum internally in the organization. Regions are mobilized. Offices of staff everywhere are mobilized. You have revenue committees all across the country operating. Our footprint is extending beyond areas that we have been. So there is a lot of momentum and activity internally in France, and better commitment to do some of these things. That is happening. And we're actually monitoring that so that we ensure that we achieve the results that we achieve. I understand that people might be suspicious about that. Most of us, by the way, are new to the process, by the way. I must also say, upfront, the commissioner didn't put a panel, the Kakane panel, certainly he didn't. And this was, again, in response to what we see we saw in the public media. I must also respond to a point you made, which I think is an important point. Maybe we should emphasize the point. We maintain that any revenue agencies will have the requirement of having some investigative capability. And that's not being questioned. And that's not what is at issue, by the way. I mean, I must say that. And I think what we're dealing with is something else, that how that is governed, how that is established, how that links with other agencies of the state is crucial. And that's what we're dealing with, really, as it were. So I really would repeat with members that we must avoid a short-term approach to this thing. Let's look at it, and that's how we're looking at it in Treasury. Let's look at it from the perspective of broadly strengthening tax administration in the country, as opposed to trying to actually politicize it or bringing in issues about individuals being investigated by the unit. By the way, the unit's role was not collecting tax, by the way. And it was doing investigation, but it was not just going around collecting tax. That's why we maintain that revenue collection remains intact within the organization. You are right, I mean, the importance of some of the people we lost, I mean, in the process around in IT, etc. But when I look at that, that's why we are paying. So that we actually ensure that there's no gap in the process of tax administration. Of course, we must train also people. So the program for training and skilling people across the racial divides in the country is important. And that's something that I think we are also pursuing quite vigorously in the program. I thank you.
You can respond to the question.
Well, Chair, thank you very much. If I were to respond to all the questions, we'll be opening up the debate, but I am prepared. But I would just want to make a few comments, Chair, with respect to the questions and the comments that have been made here, that as SARS, our mandate is very clear, and therefore our focus is pointed. And as I indicated in the opening slide, that we have what you call a riding of forces on the ground, that all of us must live to the mantra of revenue collection across the country. Because we know very well that if SARS is unable to meet the target, the consequences are very dire. It is for this reason, therefore, that we recall the minister, we made a pledge, a covenant, that despite the noises that are taking place in the public space, SARS will continue to be focused on what it is expected to do, revenue control. You recall the minister had indicated the target in the MTBPS and the review thereof. Ours is to follow the decision and the lead that is given by the ministry. Any other thing is not part of our DNA. We want to confirm in this meeting, therefore, that that which we have been mandated will have to achieve. Rallying of everybody within SARS, but with one single purpose, that where ours is to collect all revenue due to the state. That having been said, with the rallying that had been taking place prior to my arrival, it is very clear that I, as accounting officer, equal with the minister, are concerned of the erosion of the brand and image of SARS. So there is no way that I'll be a leader that is having the head in the sand and oblivious of the fact that the ramblings in the public space, which if not attended to, the reputation of the organization that we all agree to that is world-class will be misplaced by myself. So I've made the commitment that I'll run SARS to the best of my ability. I'll build the ethos of SARS on the basis of what SARS is expected and build on my predecessor's successes. So there is no reckless approach to changing things in SARS in order to follow a narrative that which I am not aware of. That I can make here. The fight and the combating of illicit trade and economy is key to any economy, and therefore we're not an island in that regard. But the Deputy Minister is indicating that we need to be able to have an instrument that is able to deal with these matters effectively and without fear or any favor. I must indicate that that capacity has not been taken away. We still fight and combat illicit trade. On a daily basis, the team that I lead will receive reports on both customs and any other sector of wrongdoing that comes into the organization that we combat. So we do have what you call a dashboard that gives us an indication as to what is it that we do in the organization. We are aware that illicit trade and the economy deprives us of the fiscal and the revenue that is due to the state, and therefore we need to have that capability. Perhaps responding to what the member of the committee has indicated, with regard to the recommendations of Sekakane, one, I have disbanded that unit. That is very clear. That's the recommendation that comes from the Sekakane. That unit is disbanded. The members have been debriefed, because we need to mention here that we're not operating from our facilities. It is therefore important that we are followed to the letter in terms of what needs to be done by ourselves as responsible administration. Would be able to chairperson and the team and the committee here provide with the reports at an appropriate time when the investigation is completed as to who authorized the existence, if any, who funded it, and how. And certainly it will address some of the issues that you're mentioning to the Auditor General gave the report as to whether these things are found in the books or not. We need to appreciate the fact that all these matters are matters that are still under investigation and it's not conclusive as yet. Indeed, we do subscribe and agree that SARS is a world-class organization and would like to maintain it as such. That we are a pillar of excellence within government and therefore our reputation needs to be maintained at that level. Now, with respect to the MOU in the establishment of this unit, we at SARS, as currently as the Deputy Minister is indicating, that in discussion with the competent authority in the country that we look into the resuscitation and establishment of capability that is within the law to be able to combat illicit trade and illicit economy. Now, I'll not be able to respond as to why we refused the prior request for the Sekakane. It is very clear we're all in agreement that if we do distribute this into the public domain, that will become prejudicial from the processes that we are conducting. And certainly it's not our interest to keep anything hidden from the public domain with respect to business. Chair, I must address myself to yourself that we are not in any way going to speak about the names of the people, because the tax law prohibits me to speak about taxpayers' names in public in the tax office. The same applies to who supplied what. Those are taxpayers' private and confidential matters. And if, as and when these matters are brought to our attention, we deal with them. With respect to staff capacity to be able to execute its mandate, I want to reaffirm here that yes, we are up to the capacity and we have a team that is dedicated to it. The resignations that we've seen such are resignations that were voluntary, and these were planned in advance. That I need to say. Some of the resignations that we're talking about, of the serious people that resigned in SARS, it is in writing and it's in my document that they had already prepared exit before my arrival. So it has nothing to do with purging, it has nothing to do with people being moved. It is on record. If anything, Chair, you may want us to share that information with you in confidence and do so. So the prospect of purging, not coming from us, is another part of our vocabulary. In any organization, people leave as and when they feel they want to. In this instance, those people that the member of this committee had mentioned, they have voluntarily left this organization, not at the behest of the commission. In fact, the issue of the IT capabilities that we speak about, we have men and women who are in the IT field who are dealing with the day-to-day sustainability of the systems. Hence, we can speak with confidence that when we say we have a national revenue forum, it is live, the technology is functioning, the technology is being maintained. Therefore, I need to indicate that there is all the processes that are in place, and therefore the request for us to have a reorganization of the structure of SARS was made with the sole principle that you need to be able to scaffold and be able to make SARS function efficiently. And therefore, the operating model that we're speaking about is an instrument and a vehicle towards that achievement. With respect to us bringing KPMG in the picture, it forms part of what we said in the genesis of what we had indicated to the team here, that the discussionary report listed the matters as probably the deputy minister has indicated, that we want to control this matter efficiently, amicably, with everybody, so perhaps can move forward with these duties. I just want to address myself to the HR matters, which I'll pass to the CEO, HR. There is a great need to have what you call a succession planning in SARS. If we are to maintain the high trajectory that we're talking about and the reputation, we need to do things correctly. Identify leaders amongst the staff and those that we can bring from outside if there is a need for that. I have no contradiction in my mind that we have men and women of resilience within the organization who can take the organization beyond the trajectory that we're setting ourselves. And therefore, the succession planning and training of officials is at the core of my tenure of office, that human resource element becomes the pillar upon which technology has to be embedded. There is no organization that is worth its ability if it was to maintain the reputation that it has if it leaves its people behind. Because technology by their nature is pervasive, but men and women who follow these things must be able to robustly deal with these issues. Stability in SARS, I can confirm that SARS is there. What the newspapers and the media are printing is outside my control. And we've made it very clear that we're not going to contest what is in the public space. I don't own the ink. I don't have the gallons of ink. All I can assure you is that SARS is in good hands. We do this without fear or favor for our country and our people, that revenue collection becomes the key component as to how we are going to be measured. Tangible examples? The tangible examples that we'll be able to provide here as comfort to all South Africans is that we need to meet our target. We have indicated yesterday that SARS cannot be divorced from the international crisis that is taking place that affects us. If companies are not performing, therefore the fiscal and the revenue that we derive from them will have an impact. So I would like to say, juxtapose the ability to get targets in relation to how the economy performs. But what is very key in this nexus is that we need to be able to do what is called taxpayer education, and that it is cool to pay our taxes. If we are not engendering this type of process in our people, then we might as well forget the mandate for which we have been, because people that are not compliant with tax and the tax modality that we speak about, it becomes an issue that we must set as an engagement across the whole sphere of government and our people for Africa. I've indicated that there's no purging, and there's never been any purging whatsoever. The minister and I in the decision that was taken in establishing the advisory committee board was a pure purpose that we create an environment that management across is worried about the reputation and its erosion thereof. And indeed, it is our duty, therefore, that we deal with some of the substantive issues. Chair, I don't want to be controversial. And if I am, you are at liberty to draw my attention to this. The resignations of individuals within SARS should also be seen in the trajectory that we've traveled. I say we have traveled, albeit I was not there, when we introduced the modernization strategy in 2007, wherein we can brace ourselves and pride ourselves that we are one of the best organizations in the world in terms of e-filing, 99%. And our turnaround time with respect to responses to taxpayers is 72 hours maximum. All of you, I think, have been subjected to this. I take great pride for the innovations that have been made in this country in this regard. And therefore, there can be no reckless approach to go and change that which is working, except to strengthen the gaps that we identify. Hence, we have brought in Gartner. The modernization processes are certain risk engines which we think we need to put in place to avoid fraudulent activities that are taking place, which taxpayers may want to exploit, having seen the witnesses that appear in the system. What I'm going to say is that we're talking about resignation and people leaving. Chair, I must say, in the whole leadership at the top, CEO, one resignation. Only one person has resigned at that level. The others are what you call middle management. If we go back in history, there were cases wherein there was a large number of people who have resigned. And my concern was, why is this thrown on my ball? That there seems to be people leaving when I join the organization is a volunteer. We can provide statistics as to how the organization has moved over a number of years. There is national statistics. Perhaps that is something that you want to have as a committee to show you the number of people across the organization who have resigned. That, I must say, that's where the situation is. And I therefore, Chairperson, I wanted to respond to these issues in broad strokes, that we shall provide the committee with all the necessary reports as has been requested, as and when this investigation comes to its conclusion. And it is my wish also that these matters are amicably solved. I, as a commissioner, would like to be leading an organization that is not in distress. I want to lead an organization wherein its members are happy to wake up in the morning in the full knowledge that they are going to serve their people and do their work correctly. That's my ambition, and that's the mantra that I hold. I have no other objectives outside the terms of reference of my opponent to lead us to a higher trajectory. That's what I want to comment upon. Thank you, Chairperson.
David, right, the wishes stroke request covered in your response as far as I can see. Are there anything else members want to come back on before we tie it up now?
Thank you, Chairperson. I was just wondering about the car.
Chairperson, I don't usually get into triviality. I'm saying that guidedly. Commissioner does not deal with the purchase of cars. Either in my previous life, when I joined SARS, the car had already been decided on my behalf. So I saw no reason why the Commissioner of SARS would come and look for a car. Now, the narrative that is in the domain that SARS pushed people to buy cars, it's a complete lie. I'm saying it's a lie. Second, the issue of the car and the narrative that is in the public space seems to create an impression that the Commissioner lies blindside. I use any instrument that is given at my disposal. I need to say here, when the matter of transport, which is an instrument of work, which is afforded to a commissioner at my level, is not something that I come and ask. It's an instrument of work that is decided by policy.
all previous commissioners had cars, so I see no reason why this issue becomes an issue. Second, the malice is that the car, in the manner that is portrayed in the press and in the media, that the person is concerned left because of the car. Pure lies. It's pure lies. I'm saying this, I'm not going to mislead this committee. No one left Sarawak because of a car. People left voluntarily. The issue of a car is a side issue, it's a side show. I, as a commissioner, am not going to entertain that, neither am I going to respond to that. All I can say, which is completely unorthodox, a commissioner, when he arrives in an organization, is told what he is right and what he is entitled to. And I've told you are entitled to this, and I say thank you. Never question. Thank you, Chairman.
If I were to summarize, just to see if it's accurate, right, where we are. Firstly, ultimately speaking, Minister, this is an initial inquiry by this committee into this matter. Secondly, we are working what might be called a complementary vision of labor with the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence. Thirdly, that we would, unless the rules or laws or regulations preclude it, at some appropriate stage, we would want a second report and any other report that Parliament is entitled to have in this regard. Four is that this committee will come back to this issue after further consultation with the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence. But before I move on, you may have said this, and I didn't catch this. Are there deadlines to these structures you've set up? Now, the KPMG report, when do you expect that? I think you gave a deadline, June. So then the Kuhn, Judge Kuhn Commission?
We'll know sooner. They are meeting in the first week of April.
All right. Can you tell us who's on it? I don't think it's been said to us who's on it. Besides Judge Kuhn, the question raised by this, I think, is a legitimate one about the two South people. But who's on it? And does any of them have any expertise on tax issues?
It's headed by Judge Kuhn and Senior Counsel Ndalenge, and Advocate Martin Brook, who has extensive... I must say that one of these people has... They have extensive tax experience, all of those people. And then Ms. Maponya, and then Ms. Mkwena. Mr. Mkwena and Maponya are both here, and both are well steeped in understanding tax environment and tax administration.
So you and the minister and commissioner meet with them and then decide how long before they report to you?
Yes. I must also add that I think there's a point that has been made about SARS officials, which is part of the, in any case, the law allows that. But I think in addition to that, I think in the initial phase, that's crucial, because it gives the both administrative support as well as strategic support to the work of the commission, which is very crucial, I mean, if it has to maintain connection with the actual operations of SARS.
And presumably the judge there and others of that ilk, they're not going to be overly influenced by two SARS people, presumably. Their report will be an independent report. So the Bain report, if there's such, when will that be finalized?
Chairperson, transformation and restructuring, much as may be time-based, we think it's an 18-month process. It's a long term. But we cannot do it hastily and say transformation will happen together. We need to do what you call surveys within the organization, identify the potential within staff. But we think in the 18, 24 months, we shall be. But we have what you call periodical reports.
Interim reports. Maybe you can slide what you can into your quarterly reports.
We'll try to that.
Because we'll be monitoring this process. And what's the Gartner report? Is that the same game, Gartner, is one company?
The Gartner is an IT specialized company, well known in the world in terms of diagnostics, in terms of the IT field and systems.
So you've given a contract for how long?
Well, they do a diagnostics and therefore they'll work with our IT team, and so once the gaps have been identified, then we'll be able to take the process forward.
but they will want to take us the whole hog because we have internal capability within us. It's to give us a roadmap and landmarks of what needs to be done in order for us to maintain a system that is able to sustain and provide SARS with all risk engines necessary for us to do what is expected.
All right. So I've covered the final point, unless somebody disagrees, is that to extend possible, we would like, if possible, for some sort of equitable settlement of the outstanding issues between the parties in dispute. Is that agreed? Good. We would like the committee, or the majority in the committee, would like to see if there was a prospect of this amicable settlement between the parties in dispute within PAS and what now exits PAS. Whatever. Okay. Is that clear? No, to the extent... Yes, no, that's what we mean. The point meaning that if there are people who are constantly challenge these things in the courts of law and so on, then actually there are ways to resolve these issues, Makosi. I mean, that don't require, I mean, it's nothing new. You, for example, this parliament has on many occasions told the executive, Home Affairs in particular, it's not in hard, it's in the public domain, every time the Home Affairs, why do you go to court when you can resolve issues outside the court process and exist? There's nothing statistically new in what I'm saying. It reflects the mood of this meeting. Members are free to disagree, but let's put the majority would like, to the extent of social honest carefully, and I'll repeat it, to the extent possible, the majority of the committee feels that where there are outstanding disputes, seek mediation and resolution of it without endless fights in the courts of law. That's what we are saying. Not everybody has to agree. People are free to disagree. Okay? But the majority, I think, that's the move. Oh, right, so then that's the point made. I just summarized what I said earlier. So, and I'm not saying anything that's profound or anything that's fantastically new. Well, it's pretty banal, actually, what I'm saying, if I may say some of what I'm saying. Very banal. Right. Okay, right. So, now can we... Tali, my sister, you said to me today you're not going to be bantering, right? I don't know why you're smiling. And why are you harassing Makosi? So you can't take the same Makosi harasses you. Right. Advocate Jimmy, can I ask you to please mediate here between Handi and Makosi? Can you also inform them, Advocate Jimmy, that I represent the, I mean, I'm the committee chair, but I come from the same party as them. They're not supposed to heckle me. The norm in democracy is to heckle the opposition, not their own chairperson. Can you discuss that with them? I don't want a discussion. I'm ruling on that. Alan, can you rule on that? Can I rule on that? Yeah, Alan says I can rule on that. Alan is God here. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you to the staff. Thank you, Deputy Minister. We'll see you again. Thank you very much. Okay, over into the final item on the agenda. You will recall that the committee agreed.
Yeah.
All right, okay. Okay, a few minutes break.
Thank you. Can you remember those 15 minutes study computer?
welcome to the Tier 2 crisis. You asked to speak to our committee a second time. So we discussed it and we agreed. I think I should say that it's not in every circumstance, not on every boat, that we will constantly engage with stakeholders. It depends on the nature and character of the bill, the issues raised, the implications it has for the public, matters around economic growth and development and so on. So we're not sitting like a hard and fast rule that on every bill or on every green paper or white paper, we'll constantly engage with stakeholders. But we think in this circumstances it's justified. Following a request from one of the members, we also asked the Banking Council. So they've written to us to say, if I'm correct, that largely they're fine with the bill. Is that right, boy? Yeah. But having been requested now to make a submission, they said, yes, they will come to us in the second week of the second quarter. Also to let you know that we made substantial progress on the policy issues on the day after you were here for the response that National Treasury offered. And we think that we're heading towards a greater clarity on what should be done. And so we do not want to spend an inordinate amount of time on the bill. But on the other hand, we recognize the implications and gravity for the entire society and the economy, let alone the stuff. So we are hoping to work steadfastly on the bill from the Tuesday of the second week of the second quarter, am I right? And it's committee week, so we're sitting most of the day. You're welcome to observe. Obviously, it's okay. So we hand over to you. We have distributed your written text narrative, and now we have before us your slide presentation. It's 20 past 12. We ask you to speak for 20 minutes, maximum 30, and then we take questions after that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So name's Lionel Shaw, representing the Tier 2 Creditor Committee. Now, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee again on the issue of the Bank Amendment Law. I think we have prepared a presentation. We will leave the slides, and the slides will be left with the committee, and they've been handed out. So we don't plan to slavishly go to each slide and read off the slide, but we will address items from slides as we go. I'm also joined today by Isabel Goodman, an advocate of the Johannesburg Bar, who was the co-author of our constitutional opinion, who is with me today to assist with the presentation insofar as it relates to our constitutional submissions. I'm actually going to turn the presentation over to Isabel to commence with the constitutional submissions. And Isabel, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I should just mention at the outset that we were under the impression that we'd been given an hour to make submissions. I'm not sure that position has changed.
In contact with you has been Alex. Sorry? Yes, but the thing is that your time would have been 20 minutes. I told him a maximum half an hour. And then what we choose to do is our decision. Whether we use 5 minutes or the remaining 2 minutes is really for a stakeholder can't describe Parliament anywhere in the world how much of time Parliament should engage.
No, Chair, I'm
sorry.
I didn't mean to imply that we were entitled to that time. I'm really for clarity.
Yeah.
Given the time available, I'd like to condense our submissions. Members of the committee and the chairperson have a copy of the opinion prepared by Mr. Cockle and I. And you'll note that the attacks that we raise are mostly go to Section 69.2C proposed and Section 69.3J. I'm going to focus my submissions on Section 69.2C because that appears to be the main area of contention between us and the other parties in the stakeholder engagement. Section 69.2C, as the committee will know, introduces three fundamental changes to the existing regime. The first is that it removes the objective of the curatorship that it must return banks to being a successful concern, and it doesn't replace it with another alternative. The second is that it enables the minister and the curator to consider whether creditors are treated equitably as a result of the proposal, or at least know whether or not they would have been in liquidation, and that is currently not a counterfactual that can be considered in curatorship. And the third major change is that even if the proposal treats creditors inequitable or it leaves them worse off in liquidation, the minister may nevertheless approve it because it is in the interest of stability of the banking sector or it promotes confidence in the banking sector. My chair and members of the committee, it seems to me as a that I sit here that lawyers, that bankers are even more inclined to make things incomprehensible and transparent than lawyers are. And so I wanted to use a very simple analogy to explain why the Tier 2 creditors consider these amendments to be so pernicious. The nature of the notes, we say, is that they're essentially similar to IOUs. And so, take an example, imagine a scenario where you as an individual make a loan to an acquaintance for 100,000 rand. And you enter into an agreement, an IOU, where she agrees to pay you at 4 monthly intervals and with interest on the amount that you lent over a period of several years. But she warns you that she has already taken out a loan from another bank and that if she does, and only if she does, that bank will be entitled to claim its payment ahead of you. And if the bank if its claim for repayment exhausts her estate, it will mean that you will not be paid. And you, as a lender, think about the situation and you think to yourself, well, your acquaintance is young, she's healthy, you feel confident that you'll get money back, and you enter into a deal on that basis and on terms where you think that the interest compensates you for the risk. And we say that that is the exact analogy to what the Tier 2 note holders have done in this circumstance. They've entered into an agreement that said their claims will back rank to those of the seniors only if the bank is liquidated, which is equivalent to, not, in my example, to the death of the bank. Now, to continue with my analogy, take a world in which your acquaintance subsequently becomes sick as she goes into hospital, and her affairs are temporarily taken over by a relative or a bank manager who comes to you and says, I see that you made this agreement that if the acquaintance died, you would be seconded to the loan of the bank. Well, she's ill, and we intend to do that in these circumstances. We say, and it seems to us clear, that that is an unfair arrangement, that constitutes fundamental change in the contractual deal that we struck, and it is a change that is brought about by the manipulations of a third party who wasn't involved in our initial negotiation and doesn't have a full understanding of the terms. And again, that is the world that we say that we're in once the curatorship provisions, if the curatorship provisions are to be changed in the way that we are. It enables the curator to treat the Tier 2 note holders as if African banks are being placed in liquidation, whereas it is merely sick, it is merely in hospital and may well yet make a full recovery. Now, our complaint is not only that this is unfair, and I think that seems clear enough to impulse based. We say that this change fundamentally violates the rule of law. The rule of law is a requirement entrenched in Section 1 of the Constitution. It promotes certainty, and it says that people must be able to rely on the provisions of the law to know how their affairs will be dealt with in due course. And we say, and there is international foreign jurisprudence that supports this position, that when that contractual arrangement, when your affairs, when the deal you have struck is changed after the fact and by the legislature rather than by agreement between the parties, that violates the certainty that you created through your contractual arrangement, and it violates Section 1 of the Constitution. We understand that the curator has procured an opinion from Unterholter and Basinder, and I'd like to point out to the committee that opinion does not deal with the rule of law complaint at all. And to the extent that they deal with the other provisions, which I'll touch on briefly in a second, they say only that the flaw lies not in the provisions of the Act, but in the way that the curator may exercise his powers in due course. And we'd like to make plain that in relation to the retrospectivity challenge, in relation to the complaint that the bill changes the fundamental relationship between the parties retrospectively, that is the flaw that lies in the bill itself. It arises from the bill's requirement that you can change the objective of curatorship, and it arises from the change in the way that the curator can choose creditors, and it therefore flows from the law and not from the curator's exercise of power. And we say, therefore, that the problem that arises about out of subordination or ranking of creditors and curatorship is one with which the committee is required to engage. They cannot pass the bill as a constitutional provision or a constitutional enactment in the current form, we say, because of the no creditor worse off principle at the removal of the objective. So that then is our first point. We say it's a strong constitutional argument. It's not one that we can say will win because it is a new area of law in which the Constitutional Court has not pronounced. But we say it is certainly a provision that entails substantial unfairness and potential unconstitutionality, and that it needs to be remedied before this committee passes the bill onwards. There are two other respects in which we say Section 69(2)(c) potentially violates the Constitution. The first is the requirement of equal protection before the law. That requirement, very briefly, is that people and creditors are entitled to expect that they will not be differentiated between arbitrarily. And so in my example of the creditor who your acquaintance has become ill, the equivalent, we say, would be that the bank manager comes in and says, they're not going to pay you, and they're not going to pay the bank who had the loan that could be ranked above yours in debt. They're going to pay some third party, the vet, the doctor, someone who up until now you haven't necessarily thought about. Now, we say that provision, the ability to pick creditors, is brought into the Act by the requirement that the curator can select creditors for treatment, preferential treatment or worse treatment, and that the only limitation on the exercise of that power is that the minister must consider that selection and the proposal that it gives rise to be in the interests of stability and confidence in the banking sector. The problem, according to the tier two creditors, is twofold. The first is that the curator is given no guidance at how he makes his selection. It really is, we say, largely left in his hands. And we say the second problem is that the minister is given this very broad mandate to consider whether or not the banking sector will be benefited. But we say the banking sector is benefited and its stability and stability is promoted by an arrangement that provides for certainty in contractual arrangements. You'll know that in the African banks, for example, there are significant institutional investors. There are foreign investors involved in the affairs, and their confidence and their continued investment in banking instruments is dependent, we say, at least in part, on them understanding that their investment will be safeguarded and consequences for them will be knowable if the bank fails. So we say there's this very fundamental mismatch between, on the one hand, the idea that the curator can ad hoc rearrange people's rights, the consequences of curatorship, and on the other hand, the idea that the purpose of that rearrangement is to promote stability and faith. In this regard, Mr. O'Toole and Mr. Badland, they have come back and they said their response is essentially, well, this is not an issue for the committee to worry about, because whether or not that becomes an issue will depend on how the curator exercises his powers. And we say very briefly that is not the case. And it's not the case for two reasons. The first is that Unterholter and Budland say that rely on a FCA judgment that says you must find your remedy in Pudger if you think that there is arbitrariness in the bill. The judgment on which they rely is an FCA judgment, and we think it stands in contrast to some very clear statements of the Constitutional Court. But the more important purpose of this committee is that this bill is being considered, as you are aware, in parallel with an actual proposal. And so the committee is not with the circumstance where the bill will be passed and there is an unknown number of variations about how the powers will be invoked. There's a very specific way that powers are intended to be invoked. And that the invocation of those powers, we say, may well open both the decision to invoke the powers and the powers themselves up to constitutional challenge. So the fact that the challenge is brought by way of a review to the decision does not mean that there will be no challenge to the bill if it is passed. There will still be the challenge. It just comes in different and more concrete form. And most importantly, for this committee's purposes, Mr. Unterholter and Mr. Badinger have not given you a sense of approval that if the proposal that is currently before the commission, which is currently being fashioned by the curator, is adopted and is used to invoke the powers given by the bill, that will not lead to a challenge to the bill, which may well be successful. I don't wish to get too far into Mr. Shaw's time, but to summarise very briefly, there is a third challenge to Section 69(2)(c), which relates to the arbitrary depredation of property. It's a matter that's dealt with fully in the opinion that runs very closely to the retrospectivity challenge. The question ultimately, and all of the lawyers agree on this, is whether a depredation is proportional, and the short answer is that there are very real signals that in this case and in the circumstances in which it still isn't anticipated to be invoked, it will not be. That is particularly the case, we say, where there is no compensation on the table for any deprivation that may occur. So, by way of very broad overview, the PSG note holders contend that the bill may well infringe the rule of law, which is entrenched in Section 1 of the Constitution, the right to equal treatment before the law, and the right to property. And PAJA and an invocation of the rules of PAJA do not remedy that challenge. The challenge will remain whether or not to pursue through the avenues provided by PAJA or directly to the Act. Related to that, the opinion provided by Unterhalter FC and Badlander does not deal with the very substantial issues that are raised in our opinion, particularly in relation to the subordination ranking of our claim, the treatment of us as a ranked creditor in the case where the acquaintance is in hospital and not dead. And it does not address meaningfully what will occur if the proposal in its current form is adopted. So, merely by way of overview, whether the constitutional challenges, we've felt that a constitutional challenge is available both to the law if it is enacted as it stands, and to the indication or the implementation of that law through the adoption of the proposal as it stands. And I hand over to Dr. Shaw to put up our alternative arrangements that we propose would be better.
Thank you, Isabel. Mr. Chair and the members of the committee, I'm going to turn to page 22, slide 22 of our proposal, of our presentation. The slides that lead up to that, if I have time at the end, I will come back to them, but they're obviously with the members of the committee and can be reviewed by the members of the committee. I think having established, in our view, that there are substantial difficulties with the bill in its current form, in that it presents several constitutional issues and challenges for its implementation and for the proposals placed on the table for the resolution of African Bank, we think it's important that we air our alternative proposals for the implementation of the bill, acknowledging, as the CO2 creditors do, that an amendment to the Banks Act is necessary in order to resolve the African bank situation. Now, we think there are three potential ways of addressing the bill and amending the bill or varying the bill that are less, to use the bill's word, pernicious, and that are capable of allowing the bill and to be enacted in a way that does not infringe or has the lesser likelihood of infringing upon the TS2 creditors' rights. So our first proposal is that it be acknowledged that the bill is an interim measure for African Bank. We understand that there are concerns that this legislation has to ultimately or potentially be used for future bank resolution. However, we understand and know that permanent bank resolution legislation is planned, and that permanent bank resolution legislation will be undertaken and implemented in accordance with the FSB's key attributes. The current rule does not follow, as it should, the key attributes. It is an interim measure. So our first proposal is really to allow the creditors who are affected by the proposal to have a say, to have a vote under some form of scheme of compromise or scheme of arrangement for them. We note that in the bill, and we welcome this, that the scheme of compromise provisions of Section 155 of the Companies Act have been reintroduced into the Act, subject to the curator wishing to apply them. Now, we say that in the context of the African Bank, if we wish to avoid the consequence of what the National Treasury referred to as the dead man clause, in other words, the clause in the legislation that requires the bank to become a going concern and that all creditors be paid, we can override that provision of the Banks Act by allowing the creditors to have the determination of whether or not it should be overridden, if it is clear that there is no other alternative to resolve the bank in question. So what we propose there is that all classes of creditors, whether it is intended to be a transfer of assets or liabilities or a compromise, a reduction of their claims, have a say by being allowed to vote on that under Section 155 of the Companies Act. And it would vote for a scheme of compromise that in the African Bank case would allow the transfer of the assets and the transfer of their liabilities, admittedly for a compromise amount. And ultimately that is also subject to court sanction. So that we think is fair because it looks at the fact that the creditors' rights are going to be deprived if this transaction takes place in the manner or in the way proposed, and gives the creditors a say as to whether they agree that their rights be infringed or varied. Now, a scheme of compromise is a well-known mechanic in company law for creating compromises and allowing both assets and liabilities to be transferred, reduced, and as it implies, compromised. And how we would see that working is the creditors have two classes, and they would simply vote at a certain threshold of creditors currently in the Section 155, that is 75% by value of each class of creditor representing the majority present at or in person or by property at the meeting. So we would see the creditors in circumstances where a rights are going to be potentially infringible or infringed, actually having the say as to whether or not the transfer takes place. So that is our first principle, but our first proposal. We understand that the criticism of that proposal is that creditors may hold out for more. Our response to that is to say, well, creditors have to be sensible ultimately, because if a holding out results in liquidation, then there is ultimately no benefit for any of the creditors. So creditors have a commercial imperative to agree ultimately to a proposal that is sensible. And so it's not so that one needs to take the completely what we view draconian step of simply depriving the creditors of their rights when they actually do have rights that are being infringed and that should be protected in these circumstances. So that is our first alternative proposal. Our second alternative proposal actually emanates from the FSB's key attributes, the Financial Stability Board's key attributes. That's on page 23 of our slides. What is interesting to us is that the proposal to introduce the no-creditor-worse-all principle into the bill has cherry-picked the one part of the no-creditor-worse-all principle from the key attributes, namely that the regulator is able to determine that creditors can be treated in a particular manner as long as they are no worse off. However, in other jurisdictions, and particularly in jurisdictions that also adopt constitutional principles against the deprivation of property rights, it has been recognized that you cannot have a situation where creditors are in fact worse off, because that is actually a contravention of their property rights, the deprivation of their property rights, without providing for some mechanism to compensate those creditors if it ultimately turns out that they have been treated unfairly and are in fact worse off. So the bill in its current form picks the one part of the no-creditor-worse-all principle but doesn't have the other leg of it, which is the compensation principle. And in jurisdictions in Europe, all the jurisdictions will be expected to implement a compensation principle. And there are other jurisdictions where the compensation principle will also be implemented. And we would expect to see that in our permanent bank resolution regime going forward. So the way that works is that ex post facto, an independent person is appointed to value the claims of the creditors based on certain assumptions, one of the key assumptions being that there's no government support. And secondly, that it is not always assumed that valuation is based on a liquidation value. So the consequence of that is that ultimately, the creditors have a claim if it turns out that they are worse off. No such safeguard is built into this bill. We understand the criticism against that proposal to be that it is too complex, that it potentially binds the state to a financial commitment, which results in a different process potentially for the package of the bill. And we understand that there is a concern that it would result in process being elongated and protracted. However, it doesn't take away from the fact that a key protection built into the key attributes by the Financial Stability Board is not present in the bill. Our third proposal is that the bill be crafted as an interim measure and a special provision specific to African Bank to allow the resolution of African Bank without necessarily changing the Banks Act generally. It's clear that there is a view that there are powers needed for the curator to give effect to the resolution of African Bank, but those powers do not currently exist in the Bank Act. And we're also dealing with particular issues of policy relating to bank resolution that perhaps should not be addressed in their entirety or attempt to be addressed in the resolution of African Bank. And so what we suggest is that as an interim measure, the Bank Amendment Bill applies specifically to African Bank, and it apply in a similar manner to the first proposal. In other words, that creditors are given the say by way of scheme of compromise or arrangement in whether or not assets are transferred and the basis upon which they are transferred, and apply only to African Bank. We think that addresses the concerns that we understand will apply if we adopt this compromise principle generally, that there will be an expectation that that compromise principle finds its way into the future bank resolution regime. We don't see how that finds its way into the future bank resolution regime on the basis that it's not part of the key attributes, but the issue for us is that we have imminent contravention of our client's constitutional rights and of the Tetu's constitutional rights, and that imminent contravention needs to be addressed. And it is an ex post facto contravention. The African Bank is already in curatorship. It's not a situation that is going to apply prospectively. So those would be our three proposals. So, Chair, may I ask, how much time do we have? 5 minutes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I turn you to slide 5 of our presentation, which deals with the question. We've worked hard, Chair, to be here. So we refer you to slide 5 in our presentation, which is a slide which deals with the concept of curatorship versus liquidation. Curatorship, Section 69 of the Banks Act, liquidation, Section 68 of the Banks Act, obviously read with the Old Companies Act of 1973. Currently, curatorship is an alternative to liquidation. It is the curatorship's aim to restore bank solvency. So, and it proceeds currently on the expectation that all debts and obligations will be discharged and the bank will become a going concern. And by choosing curatorship, the regulator, the registrar, foregoes the power of liquidation contained in Section 68, at least temporarily. The importance of that comes when one examines the terms and conditions of the instruments we are talking about. They're what we refer to as Tier 2 notes, but are also referred to as old-style Tier 2 capital, or capital that is issued under the Basel II regulations applicable to the Bank Act. And the key thing about Tier 2 instruments, particularly this category of Tier 2 instruments, is that both the terms and conditions of these instruments, as well as the regulations that enable the issuing of these instruments, make it very clear that the subordination at the back ranking only applies when the issuer of the instrument, when the bank in question, is wound up or liquidated. Curatorship is not liquidation. And Isabel's example of a person being placed in hospital pending the and there's a fare being altered while they're in hospital is analogous to this. The bank is in hospital. It is not dead. And it is only at the point of death where the ranking changes. And by the bill being altering the Bank Act in the manner it contemplated, it is retrospectively changing our client's rights. And essentially, it's actually putting our clients to death when they're only ill, when the bank is only ill. Yes. So, Mr. Chair, so that, I think, the last slide we actually just turned to, two slides, on slide 28, 29, I think the issue that we want to address is that there's been a criticism that taxpayers' money correctly should not be used in bailing out banks. What we wish to point out on slide 28 very clearly is that there is actually a gain for the taxpayer through the slipping of the good bank into the bad bank, a good bank from a bad bank. And that you will see that loans advanced to African Bank and the guarantees provided by the SOB and Bank Monetary are expected to be fully repaid with interest from collections on the bad book. So generally there's a view that it should not be a risk for the fiscus in the emergency funding placed into African Bank. However, African Bank underprovided for loans and overstated deposits and an overpay tax to the fiscus, in our view, to the tune of 5 to 7 billion rand. And in the normal course of business, future profits would have been offset against this tax asset. Splitting the good bank and the bad bank means that the good bank will be paying tax going forward, will not have the benefit of loss against which to write off the profits, and the South African taxpayer will gain a tax asset of 5 to 7 billion rand through curatorship and the restructure of African Bank. So to say that the taxpayer is worse off as an answer to why the bill should be introduced, we don't think is a valid argument. Turning to slide 29, the senior creditors are to be offered the transfer of 90% of their debt, plus all unpaid interest, and retain a residual claim in the bad bank. At present, the debt holders are offered no compensation at all in this process. It is well recognized that in the manner in which the proposal is structured, that at the end of the day, the recovery for the Tier 2 creditors will be zero. And so all Tier 2 creditors will be prejudiced in African Bank. We understand that there is actually current talk that the senior creditors may actually receive more than 90 cents in the rand. In the resolution. This is despite the fact that we say that prior to liquidation, the Tier 2 creditors have equal rights to the senior creditors, but they are being retained in the bad bank with an easy subordinated claim being backranked behind the South African Reserve Bank funding, and in fact the 10% claim that remains of the senior creditors, leaving them with no value. And our contention is that, all things being equal, the Tier 2 actually have the right to insist upon being moved into the bank, the good bank, on the same basis as the Tier 2, as the senior creditors. And that is not being offered. And consequently, when one examines, well, who's the loser, you say, well, it's the Tier 2 creditors. But the Tier 2 creditors in this instance are asset managers. They represent investors. And who are those investors? The biggest holders, amongst the biggest holders of Tier 2 debt, are pension funds. These are pension funds representing mine workers, representing municipal workers, parastatal pension funds, private sector pension funds. All in all, it is our client's contention that 7 to 8 million pension fund savers will be affected overall by this proposal. There are 10 million such investors with exposure to Tier 2 debt across all the banks in our market. In contrast, there are only 5 million or so taxpayers. So the biggest loser ultimately in the manner in which this proposal is contemplated to be implemented is actually the savings industry, is the pensioners themselves, not the taxpayer. The taxpayer in fact gains from the manner in which African Bank is proposed to be resolved. And enabling legislation that allows the proposal as currently on the table to be passed through, in our view, is challengeable both constitutionally at the point in which the Act is enacted and at the point in which a proposal is put. And we do not believe that the committee should support, is our contention, a passage of legislation that would have those effects and actually result ultimately in a squabble in the courts over the rights of the creditors.
Okay, my members, here we are, right? So that it guides the 15 minutes or so we left. One is that we agreed that you'll come in. The original idea, you'll recall, was I consulted with the House Chair about whether the rules had changed about hearings, and I was told, no, you can have people until the last moment, as you've done in the past. I also consulted with the committee members, and they agreed you should come. Now, we got to you very late that evening. The idea initially was that you would speak, and then National Electricity would reply. So your dialogue in our presence and we hear both sides, because some of the things are very technical. Unfortunately, you were not able to come, and we tried several attempts, and until yesterday afternoon, we weren't clear that you're coming. So, National Treasury, I'm going to invite you 3-4 minutes to respond to the issues before we pass. Advocate Jenkins on the legal issues 2 or 3 minutes after the members have done their input. But to say to you also that what I think, unless the committee changed in view as a majority, our view still remains that, you see, like for example, you told us about these two options, right, and National Treasury's response. The third one, which is a bill simply for African banks, we haven't set out their response, right? To me, that's new. So we have kept open the process of you engaging in dialogue. We're coming back to this matter 3 weeks from now, 4 weeks from now. So we say that if you can find each other, based on your input here, Roy, I mean, I think we should still continue with that, but we'll need like firm guidelines on how you proceed and so on, based on our discussion the last time around, some of the things we're heading towards clarity on. So in short, this is part of a process. We will only get National Treasury's full response in the first week, second week of the second quarter, that Tuesday, whatever date is, right? But you'll give us the initial response. Over to members. Okay, Dave, Dion, David, Nancy. Okay. What about them? All right. The senior business is going to say something for 2 minutes. That's fine. You want to say it quickly now? Maybe we just take them quickly and then have the members. I would suggest that we keep our questions pointed. We want to end in 15 minutes. I think the... Over to you, senior creditors, whoever they are.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Your Scripture of Life and Cash representing the senior COCOM. Just a few observations. The first one is that, of course, the senior committee has provided the committee with detailed submissions previously, and we're not going to go through that now. We've also provided a letter of support to the bill in its current form, the new wording, on condition that, of course, that the creative no worse off wording is retained. So that is, of course, opposite to the creditors. There is another caveat in there, which I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, but that is that information be provided and published in regard to the actual terms of the funding that the SARB provides at the time the resolution mechanism or proposal is made. So I think the issue of creditors and awards of language is important, and one or two observations on that. It's an international accepted principle. It's merely a flaw in this current wording as the senior creditors understand it. It's merely a flaw. It does not require the curator to treat a creditor, in this case the tier 2 creditor, in a certain way. It's a mechanism to report back to the minister and the governor as to the way in which those creditors were treated. It's not an instruction. Also, the mechanism of PAJA is available during that process to all creditors, including the senior creditors, to the extent that they believe that they have not been treated in the right fashion. I think at some point there was a suggestion made that this language be removed. That would not be in the creditors' favour at all, in the sense that it then creates a scenario where the curator has total power and discretion. So this flaw is very important for retention purposes. I think the analogy that was utilized of a sick patient is perhaps not correct. It should be a critical patient that's on life care, which is, and being kept alive, which is slightly different to someone that's just ill. And then the last thing that I've been asked to convey is that the senior creditors urge the committee to move on the ball so that the ABLE situation can be started and the resolution can be provided as quickly as possible. Thank you, Chair.
No problems in the world do the average MP have the technical prowess that people who've been in the bank for 9, 10 decades. How old are you? You're about 105, 130, you look like you're 220.
No.
We're doing as best as we can in the service. We can't do any better.
I must choose not, and there's a criticism.
No, but I mean, these issues are complex, right? Over the like course, people don't...
I'll be very brief. My concern is just with regards to the interim measure for, you know, in the ABLE bill, if I can call it that, not the next bill. We're all moving towards a Twin Peaks regulation model, and how will that affect that? You know, having an interim measure legislation to address the ABLE situation, I'd like to have that. And, but furthermore, it makes complete sense to me, the differentiation between creditors doesn't mean well to me. I believe it's ranking of creditors into subordinate groups could lead to a constitutional challenge, equal rights protection before the law. That makes sense to me. And then I would just like to ask a question with regards to ultimately pay the price in terms of the, in your view, with regards to ABLE, you know, implicit, so to speak. The taxpayer is not a question, but the pension funds. Where does the GPF fall into? What respectively do they fall into in terms of the investment? And the employment pension funds, which is the PRC, and what would that effect be? And ultimately, if you can give me some information with regards to the consortium that is in the which will be PRC and then other banks, to recapitalize the new bank, then, if you have any information on that. And who will pay that? Is there any negative indication for GEPF members?
Thank you very much. And thank you for the presentation. It was very, very useful, because it's information that we didn't really understand that well before. I'm very worried about who pays for this at the end of the day, and specifically with the pensioners. The way that I understand it now, and just correct me if I'm wrong, is that pension funds bought into an investment. Okay? There has been some narrative saying that, you know, it shouldn't have invested in it because it's quite risky. But what it sounds like to me now is that somehow the risk changed in the process. So pension funds had money, they'd been invested, and the risk was X. Now the bank got into trouble, and now the bank is not liquidated, which we don't want it to be, Now the risk of that investment is actually different because of the way the curator would want to treat the investors. That's what it sounds like to me. And if that is so, that cannot be right. Because if you look at pensioners in particular of these funds, these are not wealthy people, you know. So we really need to think very carefully about that. Also, I quite like the idea. I was concerned about the fact that this bill would obviously all act, when it becomes an act, will apply to everybody in the future. Maybe it's a good idea to be specific and call it the African Bank Bill or Act or something. Just something to think about. Thank you.
Chair, yeah, I also welcome the presentation, but there are aspects, and please, I'm very sympathetic to the situation, but I also want to make sure that I actually understand your case, and I also want to be persuaded to, you know, to understand what's involved in all this. Now, we have the trustees, which are not brought into the equation here, who appoint asset managers. And the asset manager makes the choices of investments. And obviously, they are guided by the Pension Fund Act about how much you can invest in risky assets and how much you can invest in secured kind of assets. Now, right from the beginning, I do not recall other being a deposit-taking bank. And that on its own, to me, says, if I'm a trustee of a bank, it's saying, big risk this one. You're not a deposit-taking. You're just dishing out money. Obviously, it's like a Ponzi scheme. At some point, the bubble is going to burst. Now, what I am finding very difficult here is that this presentation, yes, in as far as it is making a case on who is going to be affected, yes, I am sympathetic to that. But I don't understand, where do we place the trustees in this equation? The people who make those decisions and the asset managers. Because at the end of the day, you are confronted a very complex situation. You also don't want, as Parliament, to take a decision that is going to end up setting a precedent that is going to make our banking sector unstable. We have to also apply our minds when it comes to that. And I also don't think that if we say, you know, when we are making, I'm also not persuaded that much, and that's me, about this thing about curatorship versus liquidation. Because curatorship on itself, to me, it's not a guarantee. It's merely saying it's a better option than liquidation. Because there is a possibility that, you know, there could be a recovery in this instance. And obviously, we also don't want South Africa to be seen. We are a very small market in this big sea of global markets. And unfortunately, whatever we do as South Africa, I mean, just see now, one thing happens, Eskom takes a decision, then somebody takes a decision, the rating agents are in, and you know, they are trashing us, you are downgraded, and so forth. We're very careful about what decisions we are taking. And that is why I need you to understand whether you have actually, because you are now facing issues of legality, and that is why I'm bringing my issues around the Pension Fund Act. Because to me, I don't think that I'm not a legal expert, but to me, you can't decide, you can't make a choice of an investment
and you have an instrument that is protecting you, that you may invest this amount in secure assets, and you may only invest this much in unsecured or risky assets. Then when something goes wrong, then you come back and you say, oh, now we have to be doing this, da-da-da-da-da, there's a protection of property and so forth. Frankly, I'm not sure if this is really applied correctly. That's me. I'm not sure about other members, but I want you to actually elaborate why you have not actually brought on board, when you are actually making your case, why have you left out the Pension Fund Act and the fiscal prudence of the trustees. Because the trustees have fiscal prudence over these funds. They have to ensure that whatever decisions that they make, they don't invest in risky assets. And unfortunately, sometimes there will be consequences. Because right now, you must understand, whilst we also want investors for this new entity, this good bank, which good bank is going to, I mean, which investor is going to be saying, oh, I'm happy to actually come in with all the liabilities and what have you. I'm not sure. I don't know if that's going to be able to happen. But I'm just saying, these are some of the things that we need to understand that are also going into our own mind as we are processing this. We are very much sympathetic to the beneficiaries, but I am not sympathetic to the trustees and the asset managers, because they ought to have done due diligence before they actually risk the monies of pensioners.
But there's 58 minutes through, you've got an hour. I'm wondering about process, can the minister guide us? I want to suggest something, let's see if this is reasonable. You see, this debate should have occurred then. We thought it would be like a formal input. We will raise just a few big questions, and then we will hand it over to our researchers and come back to this in the new time. Now, I know it's going to cost you a lot and so on, but you don't have to bring such a big team. You know, one or two of you, and the stakes are very high. To fly people up and down and pay them for the day as against the billions that are at stake, well, it's for you to decide. So, Minister, I want some guidance. You see, we can rush it now. But ideally, what should happen? You see, I think what the three members have said, suggest, so David, you're covering ground, we've covered. Understandably, you are not here, but Dion was here, I don't think, all the time, you are not. But you can look it up. But even for the other questions you raised on here, do you really think in the 5 minutes or so we've left, it's fair to you to reply? Then we have to be a national treasury. You see, we don't want a situation where national treasury is going to reply 2 weeks from now, and then your old friend, the lady who seems to be your spy, she seems to come here all the time, and then she's going to ask Ellen, can I come back? No. So, yeah, you shouldn't say that in this kind of climate. So what I'm saying is, this is a joke, whoever is in pigment. What I'm saying in court is, you know what? This is not a productive way of dealing with this thing. And what I think are the options are the following, right? That maybe we need to apply our mind to one. Is during the period of the constituency, we bring the parties together under the leadership of a subcommittee to process these issues in Johannesburg, right? It would be one DA and two ANC, right? We meet during the thing. Or the alternative is we come back on the first Tuesday, the second Tuesday of the second week of the next court of parliament and carry on from where we are. So I don't think you're going to be able to reply. The questions are far weightier than I thought, and you brought up some new issues. I didn't think you would. On the issue of this bill not constitutional, everybody who disagrees with the clause, right, will say unconstitutional, and the skies are going to fall down and so on. But the substance, and if Advocate Jenkins has been mandated to come back to us, or to give him time to respond. So in short, is it possible that we, one, mandate Advocate Jenkins to do by, in 7 days' time, the full response to legal issues, we get that, and then we come to a meeting. You see, one of the things we'll have to be clear about, what is the point of looking at clause if it's not constitutional? Bearing in mind that usually the people who claim it, often, I'm not saying you in your case, they say it because it's like a bludgeon, you know, to say, ah, you're going to pass a bill that I'm, everybody says that, right? Everybody. So, 7 days' time, Advocate Jenkins, you deliver from Parliament. 7 days' time, Bridget Weary organized together with two committee secretaries. Sorry? Yeah, I'm proposing, then you can reply. No one's going to stop you. But 7 days' time, Bridget, you
come up with a research report, look at their latest stuff and so on, right? Then you give it to the committee members, and then after that, before we come back from the constituency period, we consider a small subcommittee that gets the parties together and tries to see where there is a possibility of coming together. That's option A. Option B is you do it in the open committee on the first sitting on this bill again. If there's an option C, Pinky, offer it, or tell me what you think of the options. The way forward.
Chair, I'm not on the way forward. I also wanted to make an input so that it becomes part of the issues in the basket. And yeah, so if you allow me, Chair. No, just two things, Chair, as we'll be looking at the process issue going forward. Maybe one of the things, and you'll rule me out of order if you think so. Maybe one of the things I'm picking up from the presentation is the emphasis around upholding the rule of law. One of the things that you also touched on, the constitutionality of certain clauses and other things. I think, and the impression must be captured correctly, that as the committee, we and public representatives, we are doing our best to make sure that the voices, including those of the voices, are heard. And the process of this amendment and all other law that will be engaged in, it's not an arbitrary process. It's a process that we would want as far as possible people to participate. So the I'm not sure whether this speaks to whether we are changing the law arbitrarily, or the element that we may also get, which I thought is also very important. You remember during the committee engagement, the retrospective implementation. Maybe if we can also get your view around that, because I did not pick it up, and maybe it's something that we can also, from your input, be able to get a sense around those other things. And I fully agree with what Comrade Mukosi was saying about the risk and the gravity thereof. It will be interesting. I looked at parties that or structures or those biggest holders that are also affected by this, and it will be important just for us to get the breakdown, if it's possible, of how far are some of this the breakdown in percentage terms of how far some of this pension fund schemes are being affected by this whole thing, because I see the breakdown in terms of 7 to 8 million, but I don't see in percentage terms how some of them could, if it's permissible, but if it's still an exclusive information, it's fine. The other issue, Chair, you see, the African Bank Amendment Act, and I'm speaking under correction. The proposal around, and it's the third proposal that was put. Advocate Jenkins will advise for this one. I can't remember Parliament enacting something that is called African Bank Act. So, how do you call it African Bank Amendment Act when we don't have something like African Bank Act? Because my thinking is that we are dealing with the Banks Act, and I'm just saying, can we amend something that we never had before, or is this proposal? I thought as we engage, let's make proposals that will also assist the process so that we are all in one in this whole thing. Thanks.
You see, all of these issues require a lot of time. In the first instance, you can do written replies. If you haven't noted the questions, the committee secretary will send them to you. They'll also involve the senior creditors. Now, what about process? Do people want to meet during a small subcommittee process issues during the constituency period, or do we meet when we come back? David, you've got a proposal.
Chairperson, I think we're in your hands, but I like your proposals, wherever you would like to take us in both instances. But I have the feeling that the subcommittee will give a bit of momentum to the decision. Excuse me. Yes, well, that's my personal view, and I would.
All right. So, secondly, does it seem
Thank you for that, Chairperson. Seven members is reasonable. We had, of course, had a chance to look at the Treasury one. We've analyzed that. I disagree. I want to say this now if I have the opportunity. I disagree with the 4 points in the conclusion of the other legal opinion, saying that the issue of rule of law is not addressed in that opinion and they don't deal with retrospective. So, but we didn't have sufficient time to deal with the opinion from my learned colleague, if I may call her. I forgot her surname. Everyone is calling Isabel. Which is, it seems that also today's presentation, I only received it today, so it's very difficult to prepare for these things, but 7 days from today is not a problem for me. No problem.
If I say we are in agreement with the process that is adopted or suggested adopting, if I may just direct the committee in relation to the questions on the appropriateness of TS investments in the fund. It is addressed in our presentation of today on page 26 and following of the presentation. For reasons of time, we didn't deal with it in if you could, if the members of the committee would have a look at it there.
No, they've got the report, remember?